Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I heard people talk about anger on the Saturday program, and then I was just thinking about that incident. And what I've been doing since that day is listening to specific music like Fela Kuti or Bob Marley. I might listen to old programs of Dr. Welzin, Neely Fuller, The Cows. And also, I've been listening to motivational speakers. I think one is called one of the guys is Eric Thomas, a black guy, and another guy, a black guy, is Les Brown. And that's been helping me out a lot. Like they still make like jungle noises and do weird things, but everything that I've been doing, and then along with working out, thanks to Emmy, I started working out again.
Move more, sit less. We've all heard this, but these are the new physical activity recommendations out today from the federal government. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, the updated guidelines aim to help people offset the damage of sitting around too much.
You've likely heard the idea that sitting is the new smoking, and as a nation, we sit a lot. The lack of physical activity is linked to $117 billion in annual health care costs. But the good news is you can counteract the damages. Loretta DiPietro is a professor of exercise science at George Washington University.
People think, oh, I can't go to the gym for an hour. Well, there's evidence that you don't need to go to the gym.
In order to maintain good health, the guidelines recommend you do need to aim for at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity aerobic activity each week. That works out to about 20 or 25 minutes a day. And the new guidelines emphasize that you don't have to get it all at once. So if you walk or bike to the bus stop, then you take the stairs instead of the elevator, all this counts towards your daily target. Here's DiPietro again. She served on the advisory committee that reviewed all the new evidence on exercise.
It's really an accumulation over the course of 24 hours that's important. And so moderate intensity activity, no matter how you accomplish it and in as many bouts as you can do, are what matters.
Now, this applies to all age groups, from preschool-aged kids to older adults. For the first time, the updated physical activity guidelines make recommendations for 3 to 5-year-olds, prescribing active play throughout the day. Maybe this will nudge parents and caregivers to take electronic devices out of little hands.
The increasing amount of screen time, that is a factor driving these recommendations.
Increasing physical activity in childhood does more than just fend off weight problems. Exercise can also have some immediate benefits. It can help boost our moods, tamp down anxiety, and in children, it can help them do better in school. Here's Chuck Hillman of Northeastern University, who was also on the advisory committee.
See, this is a really exciting area. The study of a single bout of exercise having a benefit to cognition and brain function.
Hillman explains what he's found is that a single workout, say 20 minutes on a treadmill, can lead to improved attention span and an enhanced ability to fend off distractions.
So we see using standardized achievement tests that following a single bout of exercise, we find benefits to our reading comprehension and arithmetic.
The effects fade quickly, which suggests that daily exercise or daily movement is key.
The secret to physical activity success is for it to become habitual. So if we do it every day, we're going to get that benefit every day.
That's Kathleen Jans of the University of Iowa. She was also on the Physical Activity Advisory Committee. She says if you start healthy habits in childhood, they're likely to carry over. And over the long term, people who have physically active lifestyles cut the risk of all sorts of diseases, not just heart disease and many types of cancer, but also a decreased risk of dementia. Another benefit? Perhaps you'll have a sunnier outlook on life.
Every time you're active, you think better, you sleep better, and you feel better.
She says focusing on these immediate benefits can help motivate us to move. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Well, see again. The people who classify themselves as white are not happy with their appearance. Now, they've taught us to be unhappy about our appearance. You see, but they're very unhappy about their appearance. I think there's an article in the handout about a woman who was, white woman who was in Hawaii. And she said that being around the Hawaiian people and the Asian people, and she said she was tall and white and pale. She said she felt like a freak. And so then she started getting involved in genetic science.
Oh, don't you hate that? That's a mosquito, a lowly mosquito, although if it's a mosquito, it may be carrying malaria, depending on where it's living. Nearly 500,000 people die of a mosquito, the mosquito-borne disease, around the globe every year. And starting this weekend at a UN conference on biodiversity, a debate over one way to take on malaria will come to a head. It is a debate over a technique known as gene drive. And in the particular case of malaria, gene drives mean altering a mosquito's DNA so that when the insect breeds, it spreads specific genetic change that could ultimately wipe out an entire malaria-carrying species. A coalition of NGOs is calling for a moratorium on this kind of technology, saying there's too much risk of unintended consequences. Scientists say halting their research, however, will delay something that could potentially save lives. We're going to hear from both sides in this debate, but to help guide us through the subject, I'm joined by Natalie Koffler. She's a Canadian molecular biologist at Yale University. She's the lead author of a new paper in the journal Science, calling for more international governance as gene drives are developed. Natalie Koffler is with me in our Toronto studio before she heads off to that conference, that UN conference in Egypt. Hi and welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, explain a little more what a gene drive or what gene drives are.
Yeah, I mean, just to take it back a bit, really what we're looking at is genetically engineering a wild species. And what's really made this possible is the advent of CRISPR technology, which is a gene editing technique that allows for very precise, inexpensive, and easy changes to be made to the DNA of any living thing. A gene drive uses that CRISPR technology to push a desired genetic change through a wild population. And it does that because if you were to release a mosquito with a gene drive, it has the change you might want, which might be, for example, infertility if you want to collapse a population. And it also has all the genetic tools to be able to make that change in all of the offspring of that mosquito. And so by doing that, it allows you to release just a few organisms into the wild and be able to dramatically change an entire population of a species.
And that's where the change is, right? Because we've seen genetically modified insects and other things before.
Yes.
But the difference is that this actually follows down through – this is a hereditary change. It's not
– Yeah. So unlike normally if you were to release a genetically engineered insect into the wild, it would mate with wild insects. Wild mosquitoes in this case, and only 50% of the offspring would get that genetic change. And eventually, through natural selections, it's likely that that change would get wiped out of a population, and so there wouldn't really be a transformation of the population. A gene drive, even if the genetic change is detrimental to that species, like infertility, it still pushes through the population. And so that's what allows for the possibility to actually drive a species to extinction if it were to spread globally.
So, okay, this is what we're talking about, the malaria mosquito right now. Yeah. But what are potential uses of this technology beyond that?
So obviously public health is a big space, but another place that this is getting looked at is environmental conservation. You could use a gene drive to eliminate an invasive species, for example, from a non-native territory. So, for example, New Zealand is looking and exploring these sorts of technologies because they have a huge invasive predator issue that's putting their native bird species at risk. There's also the possibility to use genetic engineering with or without a gene drive to provide resiliency to threatened species. So there's discussion of using this technology in coral, for example, to make them more resistant to coral bleaching.
And how contentious will the discussion be around this then at these UN meetings?
From what I've seen so far, it's become a very becoming a very polarized debate. It's sort of is looking to become this sort of us versus them situation. Personally, I stand in the middle because I can see both sides of this. I think that the potential benefits could be enormous, and there might be situations that if we don't use this technology, that is just as big of a decision as to use it. Are we willing to let all corals, you know, die and leave our planet? Are we willing to let almost 500,000 people die every year, most of whom are children, by the way, from malaria? And so I think that sort of looking at it black and white is dangerous in a way. I think what's really important is we need to have this opportunity, because it's important to stress that an organism has not been released into the wild that has a gene drive. This is early development in labs. And this is the time we need to come together in the middle and have conversations about how to use this technology best.
Okay, and you have some ideas about how to go forward, and we'll get to that. But let's bring in another. Stay with me. I want you to stay with me through this. And I'm going to introduce a scientist who is a principal investigator with the Target Malaria Consortium, one of the pioneers of gene drive technology. Andrea Crisanti is a professor of molecular parasitology at Imperial College London, and he is joining us from London. Hello.
Hello. Hello. Good morning to you.
So, first of all, what are you doing to the mosquitoes?
Well, we are, as has been highlighted before, we are introducing a genetic modification that impairs the ability of mosquito to reproduce. And the particular solution we have identified is that we attack a gene that is involved in female sexual development. So as the gene drive spread, no more female are produced up to the point that the population collapse.
Okay, and that is your goal. What are you doing? You're doing something in Burkina Faso right now. Where are you in all of this?
No, well, actually, we are not doing it in Burkina Faso. All gene drive experiments have been carried out in London, and we are planning a semi-field follow-on in Italy, on a large setup that completely mimic tropical environment. And what we are doing in Burkina Faso is what we call a capacity building experiment.
What does that mean?
This means that we are testing our logistic and capability with local scientists there. So in principle, actually, are the local scientists that are carrying out this small release of genetically modified mosquito, which are sterile, and this is very important, because in a few days they will completely disappear. So in principle, this is a testing facility to understand what need to be done in order to monitor afterwards.
Okay, well, I'm just going to interrupt just so that I understand, because you are doing something in Burkina Faso with the local scientists. But so you're releasing mosquitoes. These are not gene-drive mosquitoes.
No, they are not gene-drive mosquitoes. Okay. They are sterile mosquitoes. So in principle, after 15 days, they will all die, and no genetic modification will be left in the environment.
Right, but these are mosquitoes who have been bred in the lab, am I right? Or they've been bred outside.
Yes.
So you're releasing them to see how they would be released, how you can follow what that release will look like in the wild?
Exactly. Exactly. You pointed out what we're doing there. This is just a capacity building exercise.
And what
you will have,
and what
you will
do
have
you,
no impact.
What are you trying to find out when you do that?
Well, for example, we will find out whether we have the right technology to recapture mosquito, to monitor their frequency. We will carry out experiments to understand their longevity, how long do they live in the environment, if they're able, for example, to mate with wild-type females. So these are all parameters that are absolutely essential to predict then how a gene drive will work.
Okay, so before you would ever release the gene drive mosquito, you have to figure that out, and that's what you're doing now.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Would it be possible for gene drive mosquitoes to jump species?
I doubt, because the gene drive exploits one of the most safeguarded mechanisms of speciation, which is species incompatibility. So I really doubt that this will ever happen.
You make the point that you are working with local scientists in Burkina Faso. Are you consulting with local people who could be affected by this?
Oh, absolutely. We are actually, it's not us, but as the people. Let me make it clear from the very start. This is not a technology that we want to impose. This is a technology that we want to propose. It's up to the scientists that have the problem to adopt. And this is where I followed from the very beginning. So they have engaged with the local community. They've explained the technology. They got support from the local community. They've engaged with the regulatory authority. And they have, in principle, followed on the regulatory process from the beginning. We have never been involved in this, except to collaborate with them to provide capability and to provide the scientific support.
Okay, fair enough. And do you believe that in that process there is genuine informed consent for the people, the non-scientists of Burkina Faso?
Well, I think there is an informed consent of what the technology does. There is an informed consent of what are the possible outcome of the technology, of the limitation. Now, if you ask me if the people of Burkina Faso understand the molecular details of the technology, probably not, but probably not even the people that are opposed, they understand it.
Okay, fair enough. Natalie Koffler, I'm going to bring you back in here because you're looking at ethical issues around this technology, and a lot of people don't know about it. How important is informed consent, and who gets to have it?
I mean, I think it's incredibly important, and that's something that we're working a lot on with my colleagues, is understanding who really gets decision-making authority in using this technology, because it does have the ability to have such profound impacts. I really commend the work of Target Malaria. They are going beyond what has happened in the past by technologists to really engage the public and engage the communities that could be impacted. But you sort of alluded to this in your questions. There is concern that if the technologists are the only source of information providing that's leading to consent, that can create some sorts of conflicts of interest. So something that's really important to me and my colleagues is trying to create new forums that would allow for a more balanced, sort of independent space to deliberate over these technologies.
And, of course, you want people to understand the real science and how much control or say should local communities have when it comes to whether projects like this, which do get very scientifically detailed, go forward.
I mean, yeah, the technicalities of how it works are scientifically detailed, but I think these broader questions about releasing a genetically engineered, you know, insect into the wild, the potential for ecological impacts, the potential for even human health impacts that we might not be aware of, I think that that's something that we can engage quite deeply with local communities. That being said, I think that because these are such transformative technologies that could have global impacts, it's also important that not only is there local community engagement, but there is also more global expertise that's included in those conversations.
Were you surprised when you discovered what a green book was?
Yeah, I was.
Mm-hmm. So do y'all know what a green book was?
Yeah.
Well, you tell them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So a green book was originally put together by a man who worked in the post office, an African-American man by the name of Victor Hugo Green. And he basically had a list of, because it was word of mouth at that point.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So where I know there's a place you can stay in Louisiana near such and such. You can get gas
black,
here.
Black, right.
So
yeah.
If you're traveling black, yeah. While black, this is a list of places you can stay
safe
to get from
welcome.
California to that funeral you got to go to in Beaumont, Texas. Mm-hmm.
My grandmother told me about it because she grew up in Macon, Georgia, and she told me it could be the difference between life and death.
It's sad that we needed something like that, isn't it?
Green Book is a new movie that chronicles a prominent black musician and his white driver's tour through the Deep South in 1962. The title comes from a popular and essential guide that told African-American travelers where they could eat and sleep in the Jim Crow era. Karen Grigsby Bates from our Code Switch team reports on an effort to preserve the real Green Book's mostly hidden history.
We take the nation's highways for granted now, but it wasn't all that long ago that long-distance travel was done on two-lane roads. For black travelers, a lot of those roads went through lonely, hostile territory. So many people relied on a guide called the Negro Motorist Green Book. Antonio Relaford grew up in New Jersey and remembers the meticulous preparation it took to get from his home in Newark to his relatives in tiny Colquitt, Georgia. It was like mapping a military campaign.
Everything was planned out.
His family would leave with other family members in a multi-car caravan, safety in numbers, and use the Green Book to find safe places to stop on their 18-hour drive south. The book listed black-owned motels, restaurants, even gas stations with bathrooms for black patrons.
Usually it was typically by the side of the road there because, again, there was a problem in finding facilities that would allow us, and then the ones that would allow us, actually you had to pay a token to get in.
Oh, and the gas pumps in many southern towns, those were segregated too.
There were lines where you knew which gas was. It would actually say colored gas.
The Negro Motorist Green Book was created in 1936 by postal worker Victor H. Green. Green started in Harlem, where he lived, and eventually included recommendations for every state in the country. The book highlighted hotels and rooms in private homes, basically the precursor to Airbnb, restaurants and services that were all black-owned or black-friendly. It was recognized as an important resource by the United States Travel Bureau, part of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
This was kind of the 20th century version of the Underground Railroad.
That's Brent Leggs. He directs the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund at the National Trust for Historic Preservation. The fund is working to highlight the importance of the Green Book during segregation.
This annual travel guide was the Bible of black travel.
Jim Crow wasn't swayed by how famous or how rich you were. You could be an internationally acclaimed artist, but if you were black,
you could not have accommodations at a white-owned motel. You couldn't eat in a white-owned restaurant.
The Green Book movie shows what happens when celebrated pianist Don Shirley, played by Mahershala Ali, tries to join his driver, played by Viggo Mortensen, for dinner and is stopped at the door.
This gentleman says that I'm not permitted to eat here.
No, you don't understand. He's playing tonight. He's the main event.
No matter. No service. Right now, says Brent Leggs, the National Trust is celebrating the role of Route 66 as a beloved national road. And because the Green Book had a few motels along the route, there's another purpose.
It's also to uncover this hidden story related to Green Book sites from Chicago all the way to L.A. And one such place that still stands today is the Dunbar Hotel in Los Angeles.
In a documentary about the Dunbar's history, Mrs. Bessie Robinson recalls why the Elegant Hotel was a necessity.
There weren't very many accommodations for blacks at the time in the way of hotels.
So artists like Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday, Lena Horne, and Count Basie not only played the Dunbar, they stayed there too. With the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and the gradual erosion of segregation, most of the businesses in the Green Book quietly disappeared. About 3% remain physically. Brent Riggs hopes this new movie will increase interest in them.
As a preservationist, it's exciting because we can leverage this movie and its attention to celebrate the actual physical sites related to the Green Book.
Celebrate and remember. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
It's one thing for the media to call you Mother of the Year, but the so-called Baltimore Riots mom got an even better stamp of approval from Oprah Winfrey. TMZ just talked to Toya Graham and her son Michael Singleton in New York City, where she's become a media darling for her now famous public shaming and smackdown of her son when he attempted to join rioters in Baltimore this week.
Do not do it, no matter how badly your kids misbehave or how angry they make you. The American Academy of Pediatrics is now saying categorically that parents should not spank their children. Studies show that it's harmful in the long run to kids. The Academy also says to avoid non-physical punishment that is humiliating, scary, or threatening. Dr. Jennifer Hsu is a pediatrician and author of several parenting books, including Baby and Child Health, The Essential Guide from Birth to 11 Years. She presented the AAP's new position along with Dr. Robert Segi at a news conference last week, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So the Academy 20 years ago suggested that parents not spank. This is now much more strongly worded. I understand the new policy statement draws on evidence that spanking can affect how kids' brains develop. What have we learned in the last two decades?
So we know that the brain does not grow and develop as well once there has been physical punishment, to the point where it can cause learning problems, problems with vocabulary and memory, as well as aggressive behavior. So really, it's not something that we want to resort to because of the brain changes in the future.
And then there are other kinds of punishments that the Academy finds problematic too, right? Verbal behaviors?
You know, anything that's verbally abusive in addition to being physically abusive can change the brain architecture. Basically, these are adverse childhood events that can cause toxic stress that can lead to health problems as well as emotional problems as the child reaches the preteen and teen years.
As a pediatrician, what do you say to parents who aren't sure how to discipline without spanking?
The best thing to do is try to reward good behavior and be consistent with your expectations and how you respond to behavior that you're trying to make go away, basically.
So give me an example.
An example might be that you don't want, let's say, a school-age child to hit their toddler or baby sibling. If they're going to do that, you need to, you know, say we always use soft touches and remove them from the situation anytime that you see it happening. Some children might respond to timeouts, a minute per year of age for ages 2 to 5, basically. So sometimes having that timeout to take a break and regroup can help them calm down and then see why that behavior was not good. So the expectation would be that you don't hit your brother or sister. And then once you see that they're doing a good job, catch them being good and praise them when they're behaving correctly.
Positive reinforcement. I imagine you still run into parents who prefer to spank, who believe in it. Can you tell me a story about one of those interactions?
So sometimes I do get parents who say, well, that's the only way they'll listen to me, or that I got spanked when I was young and I turned out fine. Mm. And I think it's great that so many parents did get spanked, you know, growing up and turned out what seems to be okay. But knowing what we do now, we really need to avoid physical punishment because we know that can be harmful. You know, if there weren't any car seats, for example, when I grew up, we turned out fine, those of us who live to tell about it. But now that we have safety information and car seats, we do recommend that everybody use them all the time. So it's kind of a similar situation that more is known now, and we should follow those current recommendations.
You know, some states still allow corporal punishment, as it's called.
So 19 states, including Georgia, where I live, do permit schools to use things like belts or paddles or even spanking as a form of punishment for children. But the majority of states do not. And I would hope that we would continue to shift in the direction of encouraging non-physical punishment.
Dr. Jennifer Hsu, pediatrician and author most recently of Heading Home with Your Newborn, From Birth to Reality with Laura Janna. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The first thing we're going to do to, I think, stop racism is stop focusing on racism.
Stop focusing on racism.
Did you just call my husband the N-word?
Yeah. Nigga!
In front of my children? You just called my husband the N-word in front of my children.
Did you?
Touch me. Do it. You go to jail.
Well, we now know that that driver, that woman in the video, is an employee here at Potomac Landing Elementary in Fort Washington.
She came up to the driver's side window, and my husband's window was down at the time, and called him an effing N-word.
You live with black people. Get used to it.
My granddaughter right here, and she said she's not nice after she heard the lady on TV.
She recognized the lady.
Uh-huh.
What do you think about it?
Well, I didn't think that racism was still going on as much as it is, but we see that it is.
Troubling?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I'm a little disgusted with it.
Don't call people other names.
Now, the school system says it is investigating, saying in a statement, quote, diversity and tolerance are our core values. We expect all members of the PGCPS community, administrators, faculty, staff, and students to behave in a respectful manner. We have been trying all day to get a hold of the employee here at the school. We have not heard back. In Fort Washington, John Gonzalez, ABC 7 News.
Medical apartheid.
The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present.
Michelle Obama has a new memoir, and in it she talks about everything from her early days on the campaign trail with Barack to the Trump presidency. But she also opens up about a subject most people wouldn't expect a former first lady to talk about, infertility.
I felt lost and alone, and I felt like I failed because I didn't know how common miscarriages were, because we don't talk about them. We sit in our own pain, thinking that somehow we're broken.
That's Obama from This Weekend with ABC's Robin Roberts.
The biological clock is real because egg production is limited. And I realized that as I was 34 and 35, we had to do IVF. I think it's the worst thing that we do to each other as women, not share the truth about our bodies and how they work and how they don't work.
Obama speaking openly about her miscarriage and her fertility treatment resonated with millions of American women across the country. Because if we want to talk about the truth, well, the truth is 10% of women in the United States ages 15 to 44 have difficulty getting pregnant or staying pregnant, according to the CDC. And for women of color, the numbers are even higher. Married Black women are nearly twice as likely to have infertility problems as married white women. So what's behind this fertility gap, and why aren't we talking about it more? Dr. Desiree McCarthy-Keith is a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist with Shady Grove Fertility in Georgia.
Well, we know that Black women have a higher incidence of uterine fibroids, and by the time a Black woman is 50 years old, about 80% of us will be diagnosed with fibroids. And depending on the size and location of a fibroid, that can definitely impact a woman's fertility, can increase her risk of miscarriages and pregnancy complications. So that's one factor that we have. There's also a higher incidence of obesity and overweight in the African-American community and for Black women. When you look at the statistics on obesity in our community, they are truly alarming. The most recent statistics show that about 55% of Black women are obese in this country. And if you combine that with obese and overweight, it's almost 2/3 of us. And that is just a striking number of women who are in that category. And again, overweight and obesity can increase the risk for chronic diseases and can also lower a woman's fertility and also increase her risk of pregnancy complications. When we look at studies of women who go through fertility treatments, we see that African-American women are more likely to wait longer or have longer durations of infertility before they even seek evaluation. And so by the time they come in for treatment, often they are older, which is also a factor that can lower their chance of success once they get to the fertility treatments.
So then let's talk about what's happening in the doctor's office, because this was something that came up a few years ago when I looked at this issue, that there are some cultural differences that happen among women of color. As a woman of color, I know speaking about infertility can be culturally difficult sometimes, culturally challenging. But what happens when I go to the doctor's office? Are doctors more likely or less likely to talk about women of color's infertility options?
Well, this really begins when we look at when we first started doing fertility treatments in this country 30 plus years ago. The initial campaigns for infertility awareness and treatment did not reflect women of color. The campaigns and the ads usually contained middle class white women. And so we weren't even included in the conversation when the treatments were being promoted or presented. And so if you did not see yourself in those advertisements, you didn't feel like those treatments were for you. You didn't feel like they were targeted to you or catered to you. I've seen several articles where women going through fertility treatments comment that when they're in a fertility office, sometimes they don't see other women of color in the office. So again, they feel isolated. Or if they see pictures of success stories and babies in some of these fertility offices, they don't always see brown babies on the walls. And so they feel, again, like maybe women of color don't do these treatments, or maybe we're just not successful, and that's why we don't see ourselves reflected in these images that we see in the office.
I also recall talking to other reproductive endocrinologists and realizing that we also don't see each other reflected as reproductive endocrinologists or as reproductive specialists, right? I'm assuming the number of Black and brown reproductive endocrinologists in the United States is quite low.
Right. We are also underrepresented in that area. And, you know, it's interesting. There was a survey study that was published several years ago where physicians were actually polled and were given different scenarios of different women, a middle-class woman, a women of different incomes, lower-income woman, a woman of color. And the physicians were asked, which of these women do you think is more likely to have infertility? And the majority of the physicians, and these were internal medicine and OBGYN and family practice physicians, majority of them chose the middle-class white woman as the one who is most likely to have infertility, even though we know that the women of color are more likely to be the one. So it starts with how physicians and providers perceive infertility in our patients. And so that can be reflected in our referral patterns, how we counsel patients, and how quickly we would refer them. If we think that women of color are less likely to be infertile, then we may tell her to try longer before she sees a specialist. Whereas if we think that, you know, middle-class white women are more likely to have infertility, we may tell them sooner to go ahead and see a fertility specialist.
Hmm. And also, let's talk a little bit about the cultural elements here, because I think that has a lot to do with this sort of over the surface. What might be some of the cultural limitations for women of color ourselves in talking about this issue? Should we, you know, be thinking about it differently? Should we be less ashamed? I mean, what was your reaction, for example, to seeing former First Lady Michelle Obama talk about her own struggles? I wonder if culturally that's opening a door for us. We've also seen Gabrielle Union, the actress, talking about these issues. So it seems like more Black and brown women are having this conversation.
Absolutely. For Michelle Obama to speak about that in her book was so refreshing and empowering for all of us when she made those statements and started promoting that last week. I received so many texts and calls from people who said, did you know that Michelle Obama did IVF? And we think it's so great and so cool that she's talking about it. And we have traditionally in our community not discussed these type of things, even though we've had infertility in our community, the same as others. We just have not discussed that, which leads to a feeling of isolation, of shame, and just loneliness for the women who are going through. And going back to the perceptions and the stereotypes of women and fertility in our country, while the campaigns for infertility focused on women who didn't look like us, we were often stereotyped to be hyperfertile, to have multiple children, to need birth control more than we would need fertility services. And so many women in the community have internalized those stereotypes so that if she does have trouble getting pregnant, she feels like, you know, Black women can have babies. It must just be me. There's something wrong with me. I feel broken. And then they become even more ashamed and more closed about their journey. So I think that when we have prominent people like Michelle Obama, Gabrielle Union, who can speak on that, it gives a face and a voice to it. And it takes some of that stigma and that shame away. And when we see women who are highly successful, accomplished, and who share that, it really just equalizes and shows us that infertility does not discriminate based on age, ethnicity, status, you know, anything. It can affect us all. And so it's really refreshing to have this conversation that's kind of brought to the forefront now.
Dr. Desiree McCarthy-Keith is a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist at Shady Grove Fertility in Atlanta. Doctor, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Canada. We should move to Canada.
2 years ago on The Current, we heard a chilling story from an Indigenous woman in Saskatchewan who says she went to the hospital to give birth and ended up being sterilized by the doctor.
This option of having my tubes tied was available. And I immediately asked about side effects and risks. And they ultimately assured me that it could be reversed and that there were minimal side effects. And I believed them. I trusted them at face value as they were officials. They were doctors, nurses. So I assumed that they had my best interest at heart.
After she sought to have the procedure reversed a few years later, she learned the truth of what had happened that day.
When I learned that there was zero chance of me having children, when I learned that I was sterile, that this was done to me, I felt violated as a woman. Because a woman's ability to have children is a huge part of their identity.
We cannot tell you her name because she is now involved in a lawsuit. But since that interview aired, more Indigenous women have come forward with similar stories. More than 60 Indigenous women now want to pursue a class action lawsuit saying they were sterilized against their will. A newly appointed senator is calling on the Government of Canada to take action. Yvonne Boyer is a Métis lawyer and nurse. She is the first Indigenous senator for Ontario. Last year, she produced a report on the issue of forced sterilizations and heard from Indigenous women from across the country.
They were telling me that they had been sterilized when they didn't understand what was going on. They had signed consent forms, but they didn't really know what they were signing, or they had not signed consent forms and they were sterilized.
Alisa Lombard is an associate at Maurice Law, the law firm handling the proposed class action lawsuit, and she is in our Ottawa studio. Hello.
Good morning.
What do these women say happened to them?
Well, in essence, the women report going into hospital to have a baby, being pressured into signing a consent form while in the throes of labor in the immediate aftermath of delivery, or not signing consent forms at all. In most cases, women report being told that the procedure was reversible, if not in all cases, and they leave sterile.
And are these women all Indigenous that you're dealing with then?
Yes, they are.
And are there commonalities beyond being Indigenous? Where were they?
Nope. I think the vast majority of the women are from reserve-based communities living in urban centres, such as Saskatoon, North Battleford, Regina, and in other areas that are more rural. But aside from that, those are essentially the commonalities.
And over what period of time are we talking?
The vast majority of the women that we've spoken with were sterilized against their will in the past 20 to 25 years.
Mm. But you have talked to some who are more recent?
Absolutely. The most recent would be 2017.
So who do they say was coercing them into doing this?
Health professionals, essentially. For the most part. In some cases, you have the involvement of child and family services, but I would say that that's in a minority of cases. That does not then condone the propriety of that. It just simply is to be clear in terms of the facts. And so they would go in and in the throes of labor, which involves tremendous pain, as you can imagine, they would be approached, harassed, coerced into signing these consent forms, or simply told that they could not leave before their tubes were tied or cut or cauterized, depending on the procedure that was used, or that they could not see their baby until they agreed, or that CAS would be called, or that they had to do this for their own health, for their children's health, because they may have children who won't be healthy, for example. And so that was kind of that's the pattern of the manifestation there.
Mm. And so even those who signed consent forms, you argue that's problematic, that's not consent?
Indeed. The pillars of consent in law are quite clear, and they're also supported by international standards issued through international bodies, including the World Health Organization. There's a fiduciary relationship between a patient and a doctor, and any healthcare professional for that matter. And consent, proper and informed consent, involves firstly the patient being capable of providing that consent. So any undue stress, such as the intense pain of labor, would displace the propriety of seeking consent to a non-essential medical procedure with life-altering ramifications at that time. Full disclosure of risks and consequences and options, time in an appropriate environment to consider that information, and the absence of coercion. These are the four pillars of proper and informed consent. And in Saskatchewan, and particularly in relation to the women that I've spoken with, these procedures, these milestones were not fulfilled.
Mm. What does the law say about forced sterilization? Is it illegal?
Legislatively, no. We say that it is a battery of a sexual nature in the civil realm. It could be construed as a sexual assault in the criminal realm. What complicates that is, of course, the fiduciary nature of the relationship between the physician and the patient. And so in many countries, forced sterilization is, in fact, criminalized, and this is a part of what we're asking happen in Canada.
I'm actually surprised to hear that it isn't illegal here.
Mm-hmm. It is not.
Okay. Well, what are you hearing from these women about the impact of all of this on their lives?
I think there can be no understatement of the impact on their lives. And I just want to say, just in case any women are listening who have been impacted by this, to make sure that there are supports close to them when I discuss what I'm about to discuss, because this can be very re-traumatizing. They report, you know, physically, there are, of course, a lot of symptoms. But the primary injury associated with forced sterilization is quite obviously sterility. Sterility will mean different things for different people, depending on what, how their body functions, how they view the ability to give life, what their spirituality is, and how it informs them on that particular process. And so many have had, you know, bouts and persistent, you know, depression, anxiety. Many are no longer with us because of those ailments and those circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think we can understate the impact of a violation of a woman's bodily autonomy.
Something I heard a white woman say one time. A bunch of black people were laughing at her because they were laughing at the way that she dressed. Mm-hmm. He was talking about how tacky she was at the way that she dressed. This was on a job that I was on. Mm-hmm. They were getting on the elevator, and they were cracking up at the way that she was dressed. So she was dressed in what most people would say in an outlandish manner. Just outlandish, okay? Like she had gone out of her way to attract a whole lot of laughter, okay? But she heard them laughing at her. She turned around and said one thing. Yes, but I'm white, and walked off.
Wow.
In other words, y'all can laugh at me and dressed in all your fine clothes and all like that, but I can do things that you will never do in your entire life. I can go places. I got connections that you will never have, no matter your children will never have. That's what she was saying. That was back in the 60s. Those black people on that elevator got dead quiet.
Wow.
Because they knew that she was telling the truth.
He should resign. I don't care if he's got 2 days left, he should resign.
Leavenworth County Commissioner Robert Holland is talking about this man, Commissioner Lewis Klemp, and this comment he made during a commission meeting Tuesday after a presentation about a development study.
I don't want you to think I'm picking on you, because we're part of the master race, Nick. You know you got a gap in your teeth. You're the master. Don't ever forget that.
I was shocked. I was in disbelief. Now, I don't know if he was talking about him and her, the commission. I don't understand, but there is, as far as I'm concerned, there is no master race.
Was this a serious comment or meant to be a joke?
Commissioner Klemp? Hi, my name is Ariel. I'm with 41 Action News.
We tried to ask Commissioner Klemp, who wasn't too happy to see us when we knocked on his door after trying to reach him on the phone several times.
Do you know anything about race?
I'm sorry?
Do you know anything about race? And turn the idiot machine off.
This is not the first time Klemp's comments have caused controversy.
Not everybody does them all because, you know, we have Robert E. Lee.
Last year, the appointed commissioner came under fire when he spoke about the county's holiday schedule.
Oh, God, Robert E. Lee. Wonderful part of history.
He later issued this apology.
After reviewing my recent comments, I found disappointing and lacking in clarity.
But after Tuesday's comment,
I don't want you to think I'm picking on you because we're part of the master race, Nick. You know, you got a gap in your teeth. You're the master. Don't ever forget that.
He's not issuing one.
I'm ashamed of one of our commissioners and what he has done. We shouldn't be labeled as Leavenworth County, the racist county. And that's why I feel that we're being labeled.
You claim I'm selling crack, but you be doing that. The last Emperor KRS-One and Big Zach.
beat, I say the CIA be criminals in action. Cocaine crack, I'm packing, high surveillance tracking. Prominent blacks and whites giving orders for mass slaughters. I want all my daughters to be like Maxine Waters.
Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California is one of President Trump's fiercest critics. She has repeatedly called for his impeachment. And now with Democrats taking control of the House, Waters is expected to head the powerful Financial Services Committee. This position is going to enable Waters to slow down Trump's banking agenda and also delve more deeply into his company's finances. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Maxine Waters is a political firebrand, unafraid to talk back to anyone. Here she was on the House floor during a debate about discrimination in auto lending.
And don't talk to me about the fact that we don't understand what happens on the automobile. No, I will not yield. No, I will not yield.
And the 80-year-old lawmaker became an internet meme thanks to exchanges like this one with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin.
The Department of Treasury has cooperated extensively with the Senate Intel Committee, with the House
reclaiming
Intel
my time,
Committee, with the Senate
my time,
Judiciary
reclaiming my time.
Waters' confrontational style has earned her the loathing of President Trump, who disparaged her as having a low IQ, a remark widely condemned as racist. She was one of a handful of Trump critics who were mailed pipe bombs last month. That has only made her double down on her attacks. She drew criticism when she told supporters not to be afraid to harass Trump administration officials if they see them in public. Waters' work on the Financial Services Committee has attracted less attention, but it has earned her admirers, such as Mike Calhoun of the Center for Responsible Lending.
She is a tough and savvy defender of consumer protection and holds the feet of the banks and the Trump administration regulators to the fire.
Waters has positioned herself on the committee as the voice of the little people, quizzing bankers about the impact of their policies on small businesses and homeowners. She earned the nickname Auntie Maxine. Now she's in line to head the committee. In a recent speech, Waters talked about the huge wave of foreclosures in the Great Recession and the massive consumer fraud at banks such as Wells Fargo. And she warned the banks she wasn't about to go easy on them.
What am I going to do to you? What I'm going to do to you is fair. I'm going to do to you what you did to us.
In fact, with Congress divided, there's a limit to what Waters can accomplish legislatively, but she can hold hearings. Ian Katz of Capital Alpha Partners says she can haul regulators and bankers before the committee and shine a light on issues she cares about.
She can't pass laws. She can make bank executives and some of the regulators appointed by Trump very uncomfortable and create some awkward moments for them.
Katz points out that Trump has embarked on a major effort to deregulate banking. He says Waters can make that more difficult.
She can't necessarily change what they're going to do, change the regulations, but she could slow things down.
She can also turn up the heat on Trump. Waters has already been a fierce critic of Deutsche Bank, which has been one of the few big banks willing to lend money to Trump's businesses. She was asked about the bank on Bloomberg TV last week.
And we know that Deutsche Bank is identified as one of the biggest money laundering banks, you know, in the world, perhaps, and that they're the only ones who were, amenable to providing loans to this president. So we want to know some things about that.
Waters is quick to say the committee will look at other issues, too, but her new role will give her the resources to look into how Trump's businesses are financed. And she's made clear she's more than willing to do that. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Jails ain't tough enough. Jails ain't tough enough. We gotta have a death penalty. Jails ain't tough enough.
Congress may be on the verge of a major overhaul of the criminal justice system, and it seems to go against President Trump's tough talk on crime. A bipartisan group of lawmakers is hoping to push the bill across the finish line as they return for the upcoming lame duck session. The president weighed in on that idea this afternoon.
Americans from across the political spectrum can unite around prison reform legislation that will reduce crime while giving our fellow citizens a chance at redemption.
NPR National Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson has been following this issue for years and years. Hey, Carrie.
Hey, Allison.
So this bill, it doesn't exactly seem to gel with President Trump's past rhetoric about upholding law and order. Just explain this to me. How does being more lenient on some drug sentences fit in with his whole tough on crime talk.
Inside the White House, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has made sentencing and prison reform a top priority. He has a personal connection because his father served prison time.
Right.
Jared Kushner's arranged roundtables for President Trump to get him used to the idea. Now, the former Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, was a staunch opponent of leniency for drug criminals. But remember, Jeff Sessions was forced out last week at Justice, and his replacement, Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker, doesn't seem to have trouble with this proposal. Over the weekend, though, another important voice chimed in. The Fraternal Order of Police, they're the biggest law enforcement union. The FOP endorsed Donald Trump during the campaign, and they have a lot of clout.
Okay, so that opened the door even wider. I mean, there's been so much back and forth between lawmakers on this bill. Can you just catch us up for a moment? What exactly is inside this legislation now?
There's a lot of language about making education and job training available to nonviolent prisoners and giving them a chance to earn credits to get out sooner. That idea was not controversial. But this deal also includes some changes to criminal penalties. Here's what we know so far. It'll help inmates who were punished under an old law that gave them harsher sentences for crack cocaine rather than powder cocaine.
Okay.
That law hit the African-American community very hard, disproportionately. Those people will be allowed to go back and ask judges to let them out of prison. And moving forward for new defendants, this plan would also reduce some mandatory minimum sentences and give more power to judges to use their discretion.
So what's been the reaction to this bill so far?
I reached out to Holly Harris. She's executive director of the Justice Action Network, which lobbies for changes to the justice system. Here's what she had to say.
We're very hopeful that this bill will also lead to second chances for so many individuals who need treatment, who really want to get job training, who want to return to society, support their families, find good jobs, improve their education, secure adequate housing.
Now, Holly Harris says she knows a lot of people got discouraged when nothing happened in Congress during the Obama years, but she says Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican, and Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat, really held together and helped push this plan. The group named Families Against Mandatory Minimums also supports the proposal. They point out more than 9 in 10 people in federal prison eventually return to the community, so it just makes sense to provide more options for them in prison. Importantly, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has been lukewarm about this idea for a long time. Earlier today, he said the Senate has a lot to do this year, appropriations and the farm bill. But this show of support today from President Trump may help move justice reform higher up on the list of the things that the Senate will do before they break.
I guess we'll just have to wait and see. NPR's national justice correspondent, Carrie Johnson. Thanks, Carrie.
My pleasure.
Let's put it this way. If you don't register to vote, you can't vote. If you don't want to vote, then don't register. Then you won't be heard. Make a difference. Register to vote.
Yeah, Stephanie, I think a lot of people would argue that his firing isn't that surprising. After all, he worked at a place with a lot of sick people of all races.
If he doesn't already, Clayton Hickey might regret voting in this shirt on Election Day. It shows the Confederate flag with a noose on top of it. Two symbols many call racist.
Very poor judgment.
Regional One Health taking the matter seriously, saying it's committed to a safe, secure, and comfortable environment for its patients, guests, and employees.
Man, I can't say it's appropriate for him to wear it where he did.
We talked with one of Hickey's neighbors who didn't want to be identified.
He's nice as far as I've seen him. He came out and helped me do some stuff.
He doesn't know him too well, but doesn't think he's racist.
I don't think he's one to start trouble. He gets caught in a lot of trouble.
He's referring to an incident years ago when Hickey resigned from the Memphis Police Department. He was caught in a car with a 17-year-old girl and alcohol.
He just gets caught in all the wrong situations.
That neighbor confirms this is Hickey's house, so we knocked on the door hoping to catch him at home. But no one answered. As for this shirt, Hickey's neighbor can't decide if it's racist or not.
It's hard to say for me.
The voter who snapped this photo thinks it sends a hateful message.
It's kind of inappropriate, but yeah, especially for his occasion where he's wearing it.
As for the rules in Mississippi, the only stuff you can't wear to the polls is clothing that has a candidate's name or face on it. Clearly, what Hickey wore has changed his life dramatically. Live in the Medical District, Andrew Ellison, WRG News, Channel 3.
Tennessee.
And Stephanie, we're right here in Cooper Young, part of which is in Lamar's new district. A lot of people we spoke to tonight feel her comments crossed a line, but Lamar herself is defending the underlying message.
Tennessee's racist, period. Like, Tennessee's racist.
Explosive comments from a future state lawmaker, and they continue.
Most of the Tennesseans who voted Republican are uneducated.
This video was posted to Democrat London Lamar's Facebook page a day after last week's election, then deleted.
White men voted Republican well over 60 or 70%. So, obviously, that's a particular base of people who believe in superiority.
Lamar ran uncontested in Tennessee House District 91, a largely Democratic area. But even here, some of Lamar's future constituents take issue with her words.
Tennessee is not racist. It's the people that's in Tennessee that's racist.
I think that our country in general has a long way to go, but you can't make a blanket statement like that, you know? So I totally disagree with that.
Days later, the state rep-elect herself is weighing in with a partial apology.
We want to make sure we don't overgeneralize groups of people. For that, we sincerely apologize.
But she won't apologize for the point she was trying to make. That race played a role in the election.
What we have seen is that many of the folks who voted Republican based their judgment on racially charged rhetoric that was coming down from the White House.
So does she still stand by this comment?
Tennessee is racist.
We asked her.
Do you think Tennessee is racist?
I think Tennessee is very polarized, and I think that we need to continue to have conversations about how Tennessee can work on behalf of everybody.
But do you think Tennessee's racist?
I think Tennessee has people who may identify with rhetoric that leans towards that way. And I think that we are a very racially polarized state.
I see dead black male bodies, black men and boys in the streets. Dead niggers made into YouTube sensations. I see their executions on the internet. The corpses of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Little Tamir Rice cycled for eternity. I hear Jordan Davis's music and Sean Bell's vows. I feel black male death all around me, and I am scared.
We go now to Chicago, where a community is demanding answers for the police killing of a black security guard in the Chicago suburbs. 26-year-old Jamel Roberson jumped into action early Sunday morning when a shooting broke out at a bar where he was working as a security guard. Roberson was restraining a shooting suspect outside when several police officers arrived on the scene. A white police officer from the Midlothian Police Department then opened fire, shooting Roberson. Witnesses said the police officer opened fire even though police at the bar were screaming that Roberson was a security guard. Roberson was armed and held a valid gun owner's license. This is Adam Harris, who witnessed the shooting, speaking with WGN-TV in Chicago.
He had somebody on the ground with his knee in his back with his gun on him, like, don't move. Everybody was screaming out, security. He was a security guard. And they still did their job and saw a black man with a gun and basically killed him.
Meanwhile, the Illinois State Police is defending the actions of the police officer who shot Jamel Roberson. A report by the state's Public Integrity Task Force claimed that Roberson was not wearing a security guard uniform and ignored verbal comments to drop his gun. Witnesses have contradicted the state report, claiming he was wearing a uniform and a hat that was labeled security. Greg Kulis, an attorney for Roberson's family, told the New York Times, quote, "We are 3 days into this, and they are saying preliminarily that it was a good shoot. They traditionally take 9 months or longer."
Jamel Roberson was father of a 9-month-old son named Tristan. His partner, Avantia Boos, is pregnant with their second child. For more, we go to Chicago, where we're joined by Avantia Boos, partner of Jamel Roberson, and civil rights attorney Lee Merritt, representing the children of Jamel Roberson. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Avantia, first of all, our profoundest condolences on the death of your partner.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what you understand took place? It was in the town right of Robbins. It was the Midlothian police. And Jamel was a security guard there that Saturday night?
Yes.
And what is your understanding of what then took place?
It's just crazy. I wish it never happened.
Lee Merritt, you're representing the children of Jamel Roberson. Can you talk about what the state police are saying now, since it was state police that shot Jamel dead? Give us the scenario that you understand at this point. He was working at the bar, and someone opened fire and shot the bartender?
Yeah, so he had to expel several patrons. Moments later, they returned, one of them with a gun, and they opened fire on customers, similar to what we saw in Sherman Oaks in California just a week prior. And Jamel sprung into action. He brandished his legally owned firearm, which he displayed. From what witnesses say, he was wearing a security shirt, a security vest, and a hat that said security in big, bright white letters. He actually did what we expect law enforcement officers to do. Jamel answered the question as to how we expect law enforcement officers to deal with deadly situations. He pursued the suspect who had just fired and shot four people. He was able to subdue him, to disarm him, and to hold him until police arrived. And I've talked to some of his friends who are security officers as well, and he said they could only imagine the relief he felt when law enforcement finally did arrive, because he had to keep this person without taking this suspect's life under control until law enforcement arrived. The cavalry arrived, and they showed up and they shot him to death. They didn't give him time to explain that he was doing his job. They ignored several witnesses who have come forward to say they announced to law enforcement immediately, hey, that's a security guard. When they started shouting commands and threats to Jamel, there was a crowd of people present to say, no, he's a security guard. He's doing the right thing. They shot him anyway. And to see them now, 3 days after the shooting, begin to lay out a justification for the shooting. There can be no justification for it. We need to deal with the reality of the fact that not only implicit bias, but a permissive culture where law enforcement officers are allowed to kill about African Americans in the most absurd circumstances. I can't think of facts more absurd than a hero, so almost a superhero in the sense that not only did he do his job, he went above and beyond. And he not only saved possibly dozens of lives, but he even preserved the life of the person so that they could stand trial. That's what we expect of law enforcement, and that's what he was denied.
And Lee Merritt, the police department, the Midlothian Police Department, hasn't yet released the name of the officer who shot him. What do you know? Have you learned anything about who the policeman was or policewoman?
And that's the most infuriating aspect of this, because they've offered lip service to this family to say that one statement released by the Midlothian Police Department was that this was almost like a friendly fire incident, where as if one of their brothers in blue had been killed by another brother in blue. That's the lip service that they're offering, but they failed to behave like this was actually a crime. They haven't arrested the officer. He's still gainfully employed. And more importantly, as you pointed out, they failed to ID him. And so the community hasn't had a chance to say this is an officer maybe with a reputation that has used brutality before, that they may have information probative of this shooting. We don't know enough about him. He's not being properly interrogated and scrutinized by the public, let alone the process of policing the police. We don't know anything that we need to know in order to properly investigate this officer.
You know the state police officer was white, is that right?
Yeah.
And Jamel Roberson was black.
Right. From witness statements, the officer was white. It was a white male. And Jamel Roberson was black.
And what about the shooter that he had tackled?
I haven't learned anything about the identity of the shooter.
So I want to go to the Associated Press, who reported that Reverend Marvin Hunter told the Associated Press that Roberson was an upstanding young man who played organ at his church. Hunter, interestingly, is the great uncle of Laquan McDonald, the black teenager who was shot and killed by a white police officer in 2014. His killer just convicted of second-degree murder. Avantier, Jamel also played organ and was hoping to become a police officer?
Yes.
The reports are that that night that he went to work as a security guard, the other guard said, you have an early morning, church where you're going to play organ. You don't have to come in tonight. But he wanted to show up for his job. Is that right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Avantia was telling me that he was trying to pick up extra shifts and get some additional pay because of their pregnancy. And because they were coming up on their first child's first Christmas and his birthday, and he was looking forward to that. This would have been the first Christmas he celebrated as a father. And it's interesting you bring up the Laquan McDonald shooting and the relation to this case, because that same public integrity unit that investigated Laquan McDonald and justified that shooting prior to a judge coming in and releasing that tape. And it was public pressure that caused the indictment of the officer who shot Laquan McDonald. And so it causes me to give pause to any conclusions that the public integrity unit comes to, because in a shooting that was clearly unjustified, they found no wrongdoing on behalf of that officer. It took over a year and continued community pressure and exposure before the truth was arrived to. And so we're in for the same fight, and we're not just going to simply rely on their conclusions.
So what are the steps, Lee Merritt, that you're going to be taking now with the investigation?
Well, we're running a parallel investigation of our own, and where we get to the bottom of some of the information that they're refusing to release. So on behalf of the family, we've hired investigators. We're out gathering witness statements. We are going to supplement the state attorney's office investigation so that they're not only relying on the police to police themselves and relying on their report. We believe that Kim Fox, if she has the proper information in her hand, and that's the state attorney here or the district attorney who will be responsible for prosecuting this officer, she can present a proper case before the grand jury, return an indictment, and get justice for this family.
Avantia, Jamil's mother immediately filed a federal civil rights lawsuit. Are you planning to sue as well?
And I'll answer that question. I'm sorry for her. We want to put the proper emphasis on the criminal investigation. A civil suit is appropriate to hold the department accountable, and there will be a time for that. But we feel like the suit that has been filed is premature. And while that's a part of the reason we're investigating and the reason that we're involved, as a community, as a family, on behalf of Jamil's children, we want justice. And so we want to put first things first.
Avantia, I know this is just incredibly hard. You have a 9-month-old, and you just learned that you were pregnant with your second child. What will you tell your children about their dad, Jamil?
He was a hero. He loved his son, and he was a protector of anybody he knew.
Well, we will certainly continue to follow this case. Avantia Abous, again, our condolences on the death of Jamil. And Lee Merritt, the civil rights attorney representing the children of Jamil Roberson.
Context of white supremacy. The black male protector. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, November 17, 2018. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, suggestions, questions, commentary on any of the news items that we just heard. The number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943 pound, press star 61 if you would like to participate. We did talk quite a bit, or at least I spoke quite a bit about the idea or notion of a black male, really any victim of white supremacy, but specifically since Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, was talking about black males providing protection, and that came up before. And I said several times, I think that that is important. The Stand Your Ground shooting that happened in Florida, black male was shot, another parking dispute, heard that in the sound clips this week. Heard that there, and I said that's just not logical in a system of racism, white supremacy. Black males are not even able to protect themselves. And then a black security guard executed by a white suspected race soldier. That's what it's crucially important. If there are any listeners who do not see the logic in terms of why I think it's not logical, it's not accurate, it is not possible for a victim of white supremacy to protect anyone. Now, people have a different definition of, you know, what we mean when we say protect. Maybe, you know, I've never heard anyone, never heard confusion about that term, but I do hear people say that on a regular basis, particularly about black males protecting, and that's just not possible. And I think that's another one. Community, some of these are just their major flaws in terms of setting you up to consistently have expectations that are out of alignment with logic. Things to get to before we get to callers. The Cows is listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. You'll see the PayPal button in the top right corner. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested for a decade of counter-racist broadcasting. If you're not into PayPal, you can drop me an email and I will get you a physical mailing address. Tremendous gratitude to all the folks who have kept us on the air for a decade. I hope the program has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. You can also support visiting or picking up items from the Amazon wish list. It's at Amazon under Gus T. Renegade. It is also linked at my blog right underneath my PayPal button. Extraordinary thanks to all the folks who have selected items from my wish list for the last 10 years, basically. I hope the program has been contributing to non-white people worldwide getting a more accurate understanding of what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what it means to be classified as white. One other comment that I wanted to make about Jamel Roberson, my BFF, Amy Goodman, or I guess that would be two comments, my BFF, Amy Goodman. Repulsive, the suspected race soldiers, these white journalists, when they get to come in and interview as though they have some sort of concern or empathy for a black person. And yes, tell us how it felt when your family member or, you know, daughter, child, husband, tell us how it felt now that they're dead, been executed. Hurts, doesn't it? Yes. Tell us how much it hurts. What are you going to tell your children about this dead Negro? Wow. So sad. How sad is it? Give us a detail. Give us an idea. Like, they do this sort of thing all the time. Major act of racism. That's point one. Point two, they said the victim of white supremacy, Mr. Roberson, that he was attempting to get extra hours because the approaching horror days. He is a victim of white supremacy. Certainly, if anyone has VGQ, he he is a victim guaranteed qualified, you know, whatever response or how he felt about racism, white supremacy, and, you know, what he wanted to do for the holidays. That being said, I do think it's very important, the system of white supremacy, that we be mindful about just how we use our time and energy, and even, you know, how we conceptualize our time and energy, that, you know, not, you know, if you want to work hard to get some extra money to do things for your family, that is wonderful. That is, you know, admirable, you know, who doesn't, you know, want to do that. But doing that in the name of Christmas, holidays that traditionally support racism, white supremacy, and at least speaking for Gus T, I'm not aware of how one could support so-called Christmas without simultaneously supporting the system of racism, white supremacy. I mean, I guess you could, if this is going to entail what they call gift purchasing, maybe you could find a lot of Black-owned establishments and purchase from them directly. So maybe, I don't know, maybe that was what Mr. Roberson was going to do, or maybe he was going to buy a bunch of copies of, you know, Mr. Fuller's code book or the ISIS papers and give those out as gifts. That's not what I traditionally see, though. You know, I'd be doubtful of that sort of thing. But I just, that did, not the most significant aspect of that clip. Black misandry, exactly. That's why I read Dr. Curry, the man not, that's what we're reading every Friday. We just did our third segment. I read that portion. I see dead Black male bodies. YouTube, he meant that is the very first pages of The Man Knot, Dr. Tommy J. Curry. We're reading it on the book club. He talks about that exactly. Other items to get to before we get to the callers. Did you all catch the Bill Cosby PSA to vote I included in the clips? I think it preceded the news segment about the white male in Mississippi who wore the noose to the election poll, but Bill Cosby. Spanking. I am not a parent. Make sure mandatory. I do not have children. That said, any parents that are listening to the program, this is not a broadcast for spectators. I included the segment about spanking, and they said that, you know, no corporal punishment, and this causes brain damage. That's exactly what they said in the report, that this has an adverse impact on how a child's brain develops. We talked about this with Asada Kirkland on the program a couple years back. She has a book about no spanking, and there should be no sort of physical punishment of children, particularly for Black children, how this has been a big part of racism, white supremacy. We talked about this on the program then. I know we had some listeners who said, you know, they did not agree. They think that, you know, some measure of spanking, obviously not abusive, but some measure of physical punishment is acceptable. Just revisiting, do we still have parents or people who, you know, you don't have children now, but you know this is something that you want to do, and you're planning, looking forward to having children at some point. Do you think that will be a part of your counter-racist parenting, corporal punishment? And if so, why? If we have any parents currently, and that's, you know, been a part of your parenting, counter-racist parenting arsenal, I would appreciate commentary on that, because I thought that was a really important segment. Brain damage. Continuing. Lewis Klimp in Leavenworth County. This is the white commissioner who said, I think he said, we're the part of the master race. I think he was talking to someone who was also white, although I couldn't see the individual that he was talking to. When they reporter went to ask him, this is a suspected racist, went to ask him about this, and he said, do you know about race? He turned and asked her a question, and the reporter said, you know, excuse me? Like, she was confused. That right there causing confusion. And he says, do you know about race? And it immediately reminded me of our president, Donald J. Trump, his performance last week at the White House when the black victims, black female journalists asked him the questions, or the one specifically from PBS, when she asked him the question about the white nationalists, and he said, that's a racist question. Black people love me. Did you see the racist vote? That's a racist question. Exact same way of totally turning it around when the person is being asked, maybe you might be doing something racist, maybe we should inquire about that, and they completely are able to turn it around. Masterfully done by Mr. Lewis Klimp down in Leavenworth. The NPR segment, I thought that NPR, I suspect that they were deliberately practicing racism, because that segment didn't really have much to do at all with her nickname being Auntie, Congresswoman Maxine Waters. NPR, that's what they include in the segment, in the title for the segment. I can read you the exact title. Auntie Maxine Waters gets ready to take on the banks at House Panel Chair. So that's the very first word that you see, Auntie Maxine. I will be the first to concede, I am not what they call a political junkie. I am not a historian on the political career of Congresswoman Waters. So I've not heard every report and how she's been referenced for decades now that she's been in office. That being said, I have heard, you know, and reported on Congresswoman Waters repeatedly. Throughout the years, I've heard her discussed. I've read reports. I've seen her directly. She's on, you know, television and in front of cameras on a pretty regular basis. I do not often hear people call her Auntie. And that strikes me as suspicious, just because we are talking about a United States Congresswoman. We're not, you know, talking about just and her age. It's just like, I don't hear people talking that way. I didn't hear people talking that way about Uncle John McCain, Uncle Joe Biden. I just don't hear people using that term, with all of the racist implications of Uncle Remus and Auntie this. Just for them to have that as the title, as though there's going to be some exploration of, you know, why are they calling her Auntie Maxine, or when this nickname came up, or even it's way too familiar. We're not friends. We're not homies. I don't think NPR. I don't think Congresswoman Waters is a supporter of NPR like that. I don't think she's been a decades long affiliate where they're just on that sort of personal level with her. That just to me seemed like it could have been a deliberate act of racism, white supremacy. I could be in error. This is not exactly a yoga incident. It is mildly related, because I generally go to the grocery store after yoga, so it's kind of a post-yoga activity, ritual almost. I'll even give the name. This is Trader Joe's. I don't feel any type of way about saying that. Trader Joe's is kind of a popular chain in this part of, or in the U.S. period. I think it's becoming more popular, particularly in major cities. They have reasonably priced items, and you can get a lot of, if you have diet restrictions, if you're into the gluten-free or the keto diet, or if you're vegetarian, vegan, they have a lot of options for that. So very popular. They have a lot of Trader Joe's here in Seattle. They have a lot of them in California as well. There's a Trader Joe's like two blocks from my residence, less than 5 minutes to walk there. So they have a number of Black employees, period, that work at this Trader Joe's. And I've seen them. I've been at my temporary flood residence for almost a year now, so I've been seeing them regularly. And there's a Black female. I see her. I speak. I'm cordial. It's no nothing flirty. She has a boyfriend. Nothing flirty. Just being courteous. Another Black female. Try to be nice. And I see her on a regular basis. So I saw her this past Sunday. We spoke briefly. I think I made some sort of crude joke. They had her stocking bananas, and I made some sort of crude racial joke. Ha ha. And we moved along. Maybe we talked 5 minutes, I'll say. I see her again on Tuesday, and she says, oh, my goodness. When you were here the other day, as soon as you left, my employees, she said four or five of them. I'm just saying that because she put a specific number on it. She didn't say a couple. She didn't say several. She didn't say a few. She said four or five of them came over and said, oh, my goodness, are you OK? Did he harass you? Was he trying to do something to you? And she was like, what are you talking about? Like, I've known him for a long time. Like, you know, that's my pal or whatever word she used. She says, yeah, you know, I know him. And she's they are like, oh, we were concerned. We thought he might have been harassing you. We didn't know if we needed to, you know, alert security. And they do have security that works at this Trader Joe's. And so they're like, yeah, we didn't know if we needed to alert security or what. She's like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, I know him. Like, you know, that's my friend. They're like, really? Oh, my gosh. Okay. Right. Now, and I pause as she's telling me all of this because I'm putting this in context. The number of incidents that I've had just at this store, two of them just in talking to her. I was there previously. I reminded her I was there previously. I think this was in the springtime of this year. I was there. We were talking. This was another victim, black male. I was talking to her and I stepped away. I had my shopping cart. I stepped away. This was in the morning. And this black male came up to her and said, oh, that guy right there, talking about me, that guy right there, he's picking up items and just putting them back anywhere on the shelf. You need to go and do something about that guy. And so she came up to me. I was like, man, this guy just came and told on you. You were talking to me the whole time. So that's one. I came in a different time. This was probably around the same time in the spring. I came in and they said, hey, security comes up. Haven't you been banned from the store? And I said, excuse me? And he said, haven't you been banned from the store? There's a guy in here with a water bottle that was banned. And I did have my water bottle. I stay hydrated, yoga. I said, no, I've not been banned from the store. I don't even remember what I was trying to get. And he says, oh, okay. I'm sorry. I made a mistake. And he left. I even give you one more. I had on my cow shirt. Had a random white woman come up to me and she said, oh, I love your shirt so much. I've been a foreigner. I've been out of the country. I know what it's like to be an outsider where people think that you are off the wall and violent. I was in the frozen section when a white woman stopped me at the Trader Joe to say all that. So constellation of incidents that have happened at this store that added to the list. I said, wow, I really need to be mindful when I come to this store, or maybe I need to not shop here at all. But yeah, that's moving forward. Trader Joe's in Seattle. The segment about sterilization in Canada, where they said that forced sterilization is legal in Canada. I thought that was an important point. People talk about studying laws that forcible sterilization is legal. That's might be something significant to point out the next time that people get on that rant that they're going to leave the U.S. They don't like it here anymore. President Trump is ruining things. They're going to Canada. Legal sterilization north of the border. Speaking of legal sterilization, one of Gus T's all-time favorite, or not all-time favorites, top 10, top 5 books all-time, Harriet Washington, Medical Apartheid. I did reference that text before going to the segment on Michelle Obama's book, former first lady, where she talks about in vitro fertilization. But just in reference to both that segment and the segment on forced sterilization in Canada, just quickly from Medical Apartheid, one of the best sentences in the book, I think. Let's see if I can pull it up here. I have my notes, my highlights from the text. Mouse is being a little funny for some reason. Let's see if it takes a whole lot of time. I can just get the page later because I already have it highlighted, but that's curious. Oh, there we go. Okay. So it reads... Oh, I guess it's not. It's still not doing it. I thought I had. Oh, there we go. Okay. So one of the most important sentences, or two sentences in the text, talking about within a century of the end of slavery, Harriet A. Washington, the great, she writes, within a century, reproductive coercion had taken a 180-degree turn for black women. During slavery, black women had been forced to procreate, but now they were being forced into sterility. The consistent factor was white control. Three sentences, actually, but the great Harriet Washington, medical apartheid, top five all time, thought of that with both of those segments. Dawn Lennon, the white woman in Maryland, elementary school educator, who called the black male a nigger. Great report for the folks who take the position whites are not afraid of black people. I do think that fear is white genetic annihilation, exactly what Dr. Welsing talked about, not fear that, you know, niggers are going to do something to me or bother me or what have you. I think it's exactly as Dr. Welsing articulated in the ISIS papers, and that provokes all of the violence, aggression, terrorism that we just heard in the news reports. But I think specifically with Dawn Lennon, I think victims should look at the video segment of what transpired in that. You can look at the news reports, but I mean, really look at the video segment. That is one of the best illustrations of, in my view, what a gangster is. We talk about gangster and throw this around. Oh, that's, he's a gangster. She, Dawn Lennon, that is a gangster. She did not walk up to the car, and she's 70. This is not, you know, someone who's 30 and got big muscles, 70 years old. She's got her gray hair. She's walking slow. And she goes up. I was upset. Nigga didn't do what I wanted with the parking space. Look here, nigga. And the black female, she has her recorder out. You know, did you just call my husband a nigga? She looked. Did I stutter? Did you not hear me? Yes, I called the nigra a nigra, and she has on her red skin jacket. I mean, total race soldier. Like, I'm letting you know, I am 70. I got a long history of putting it down. Coons, redskins, any of you colored nigras, you know what it is. And she even walked up to her and she said, go ahead, put your hands on me. You're going to jail. I want you to chimp out. I want you to get out here and get rowdy, because I know how to handle that too. Get rowdy. Oh, you're not going to? Okay, well, fine then, niggers. I'm going to go about my total gangster. That's what I mean. We just talked about that on the program yesterday with workplace racism. Stacy in the UK, she says she was assaulted on the street by a white woman. She was talking about they're giving so much attention to white males being violent and active shooters and what have you, which is, you know, the case in the system. However, Dr. Curry emphasized this in the Man Not yesterday as well. You cannot have a system of white supremacy without white women. Dawn Lennon, outstanding illustration, and a school, elementary school educator. Next. Clayton Hickey in the same, you can think of this similarly. She's an elementary school educator. I don't know if she was in the classroom directly, but they said she worked at the elementary school there in Maryland. Clayton Hickey, this is the race soldier in Maryland who wore the noose to the voting poll. He was a former enforcement officer. And he worked at the hospital. That's where they alleged that he's now been terminated from the hospital. Enforcement officer, hospital. This is the shirt that he got up and deliberately chose to wear to the voting booth. This is another one for the white people are ignorant about racism. I guess he was ignorant. And what did they call it? They call it colorblind. Yes, when he got his favorite noose shirt to wear to the voting polls in Mississippi. It continues in that report when they went out to do the interviews. And so they started to find some of Mr. Hickey's white pals and talk to them. And they say, hey, do you think Mr. Hickey is a racist? Guaranteed they're not going to say yes. Yeah. Doesn't matter what he had done. He could have actually lynched, you know, 8-12 niggers. And well, I don't know. Those niggers probably did something. But of course, it's hard to say. Yeah, he just, what did he say? He said he gets caught in trouble.
And then they started to itemize the trouble that he gets caught in. While he was an enforcement officer, he got caught with alcohol and a 17-year-old. That's one of those where I think it's important to use the term child rape. Like, let's not, we're not going to use statutory. Let's use child rapist. Reminding me of Daniel Holtzclaw, OKC. Child rapist and using a badge as a child rapist. And then you go from the police department to the hospital, presumably wearing your noose paraphernalia the whole way through. System of racism, white supremacy, and all the while still not identified as a racist. Just get caught in a little bit of trouble. White people don't get fired. They get transferred. I'm sure he will be, you know, someplace else. Maybe he'll be at the courthouse somewhere soon. They'll find a spot for him in Mississippi, I am sure. And he even called him a nice fella. He said he gets caught in trouble and that he is a nice fella. He comes out to, you know, help me around the yard and what have you. That right there, that is the Voltron effect. Mr. Fox wanted another one. That is a great illustration right there. You can get an outstanding character witness under any circumstances, the system of racism, white supremacy. I will stop there. Again, parents, corporal punishment, definitely be interested in hearing your thoughts. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If we could not use metaphors for this program specifically, that would be appreciated. Frequently, racists, they will use metaphors to practice deception, racism. They will insist that two separate entities are identical, exactly the same. Often, they are not. Victims, we've been exposed to this misconduct for a number of centuries, and many of us, Gusty included, we are still learning. As such, often, we will talk about particular subjects, and we do not have all of the logic to articulate our views. So in place, we will use a metaphor, analogy, and frequently, as opposed to providing clarity, it just increases confusion. If we could speak directly, explicitly to what it is that we are saying, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your commentary, that would be great. Just make sure everybody gets at least one opportunity to speak. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could please use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just helps minimize distortion in the broadcast. So you can, you know, say whatever you need to and then just mute your line if you know you got noisy folks around you. With that, we will get to the phone lines. Let's see, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up. If you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. A little bit on the clips. The mosquito one, it definitely was alarming, to say the least, because just imagining if you, because they were talking about, you know, making mosquitoes that can wipe out a whole generation or wipe out a whole species. And I'm like, that doesn't sound right. You know, you have some, you know, people who, you know, people in charge who are saying that, you know, they want to save the endangered animals, but then you also have these people who are creating living things to kill off a whole another living thing. I'm like, what kind of genes do you have to be that dedicated to your, I don't know, to your system. I don't know. It's diabolical. I remember when I went to the museum and I forgot what it's called, where Dr. Martin Luther King, where he passed, when I went there, and helped me out because I forgot the name of the museum, but they had a Lorraine Hotel there. Yes, the Lorraine Hotel, that museum. And they had a green book there, and it was really amazing. And I still have the picture of it. But yeah, they had a lot of nice things. I remember seeing a Gil Scott Heron album cover too. The spanking clip, it seemed like, I thought it was interesting how she said, the researcher or doctor or whomever she was, how she was saying that the children need to be in timeout for, and I don't have children, by the way, but children need to be in timeout according to the age they are, like the length. And I was thinking, like, how did they even come up with that? Like, how do you know even to study that? I'm sure they didn't, of course, basically put babies in, timeout jail and then kind of figure out, okay, well, these group of babies, they seem like they're, a lot better. But then it also makes me think about, how they let bad things happen. And then they see the ones who, were able to get past these bad things and they kind of use that. I guess I'll just say one other thing. At the plantation that I'm at, I'm really trying to focus really hard on what I'm, the task at hand and not the stuff that's going on around me. Two white men, they're over near where I sit now, and one, it's so frustrating. I remember before when I used to talk about the black lady who kind of set stuff in the work area where I was at, and I'm just politely, saying, hey, can you, move yourself? This white man, this suspected racist, really a racist because he did have a story, but I won't even go into that. But he just completely set stuff, just really over where I work at, the work area that I'm assigned to. And I finally had to say something to him, he had set something that the person who he has to share a work area with, he had set something out that they had had. I'm like, why don't you just put it back in the desk? And I'm like, this is I feel like I'm kind of like subliminally being terrorized, and it is like really hard to concentrate at times, but I'm really trying hard to just kind of lead that at work. But he also was saying something that he had basically a damn you Obama moment, talking about how his father, and they were talking about the president, and I was just listening, but I can't even really listen anymore because it's just too much to take in, I guess. But I know that's been one of the things that on my mind, talking about, how his dad didn't really like Obama and how he thought that Obama was going to mess up the nation, but he's not like that. And he's from the South. And I know how bad it was for black people. He literally said, I know how bad it was for black people in the 1940s and 50s. And I didn't think he was that old. And I just had to walk away. So I'm like, he was talking to other black people, but it's like, I can't address this individual. It's going to be too time consuming and too much of my energy. But I guess I'll leave it there. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Workplace racism Thursdays now. Oh, wait a minute. It's Friday. I'm even confused still. Fridays. Workplace racism is Fridays now. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We just had it yesterday. Walking away is generally, most of the time, I was going to say always, but most of the time, walking away is a solid counter-racist strategy. Minimizing contact, got to get back to work, other things to do, didn't say anything incorrect. That generally is a strategy that will be successful in not causing other problems in most circumstances. Much obliged, Red in Nevada. Others who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Steele.
Howdy doody, everybody. It's Ken Steele, and I'm here in, for the moment, I'm in Whittier, California. And I wanted to start by talking about the security guard shooting. You know, I think that's an excellent point that you made about the fallacy or the idea.
Mr. Steele, your volume dropped very, very low. We can not really hear you. Your volume dropped really, really low. Not hearing you at all now. Let's see. Still not hearing anything at all. Not sure. Let's see. We can give you a few moments to see if your audio situation is corrected. Still not hearing anything. We'll give you a few seconds to see if your audio situation is corrected. We'll take another caller and then we'll check back in with Mr. Steele, see if his line has been corrected. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is my first time calling, so I'm a little bit nervous, and I'm also at work, so I have to make this quick. I appreciate your broadcast. I've been a supporter for some months now. I really appreciate the information that you provided. Very constructive. Victim in Austin here, Austin, Texas. Just a quick comment on the news segment about security guard who was murdered by a race soldier. I feel that this is like a 21st century butt breaking technique. And it scares me because I have, you know, I have nephews, I have brothers, you know, and I'm, you know, just terrified for them. But I, you know, just quickly, I want to make that comment. I really do feel that, you know, when these murders happen, that it's just to send a message that they don't want Black men to protect their families, and they want the families to feel that they can't be protected either. So, yeah, that's all that I have. But thank you again for allowing me to speak. I didn't want to be a spectator. As you've commented before, you know, this isn't a spectator sport, so I want to chime in. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your commentary. Wonderful to hear from first-time callers. Always, don't be nervous. I did talk about that protection thing specifically. Does it make logical sense that no victim, no subject of white supremacy racism can protect anyone, including themselves? Do you understand logically? Does that make sense to you?
Yes, sir. Yes, it does.
Just making sure. Don't want to be saying wacky, illogical things when we're talking about racism, white supremacy. If other folks, if there is anyone listening who says, oh, yeah, I think you can protect, you know, you can provide protection to someone, yourself or someone else, while you are a victim of racism, white supremacy, then I would like to hear that explained logically. I guess I'll check in with Right. Did you have more, ma'am? Did you have more you wanted to share?
Nope, that's it. Just thanks again for everything. I really appreciate it. Really appreciate the broadcast.
Thank you so much for dialing in. Hope you are safe as you are on the plantation this evening. Remain safe and alert for sure. I'm sure they're probably listening in now as you're calling in. Mr. Steele, let's check to see if your audio has been corrected. Mr. Steele, are you with us? Not hearing anything. Are you there, Mr. Steele? May have had to hang up and dial back in. We're not hearing you at all. So if you are with us, Mr. Steele, we're not hearing anything. You might need to hang up and dial back in, but we're not hearing you at all. Others who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary and we've not heard from you, proceed.
Can I be heard? Oh, please go ahead.
Draptomania. Thank you, sir.
Hi. Hi, Gus, and the rest of the callers. It's good. I was just checking in, and You know, I haven't really been able to participate in a program because I've been on a temporary assignment. I got a little job. So, you know, I haven't been able to participate like I used to. But I listen in while I'm at work. I work second shift. In regards to your question, can Black men protect their families in the system of white supremacy? Was that the question?
Well, it's generally it's focused on Black males, but I'm saying the logic would apply to anybody, any subject of racism, white supremacy. Can they protect anyone, themselves included?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, they couldn't do it during slavery when masters used to come and pull, you know, their wives out in front of them and rape them, the children or whatever. There was nothing they could possibly do. And it's basically it's the same premise. So absolutely not. And I just wanted to kind of speak up on what's going on at my job. I right now I am working with primarily it's all non-white Black individuals, but sadly to say it is a very toxic environment, but that is to be expected in the system of white supremacy. And I realized that only through listening to you, the Cal Show, listening to Nellie Fuller Jr. and Dr. Francis Kress Wilson. Basically yesterday I really see what it is what it really means to get snitching for a personal gain. I had a situation last night where a coworker basically tried to snitch on me for personal gain, but I am proud to say that I handled the situation really well. I was not emotional. I did not react. I have learned to respond, and I would contribute that to the Cal Show and other things that I'm doing in my life also. But we're all victims of the system of white supremacy, racism, but, you know, it can be a challenge working with victims that are, that are victims of white supremacy. And we just, you can see the behaviors, the toxic behaviors and the things that we tend to do to each other. And, it's just a challenge. But I got through the situation, basically the guy tried to make himself look good, make me look bad to the boss and make it seem like I wasn't doing something I was supposed to do. And, I just handled the situation very professionally. I didn't react, didn't get emotional. And like I said, and I attribute that to listening to workplace racism. Because prior to that, when I started listening to your show, I was not codified in my behavior at all. So, it was funny because I was listening to one of your archive shows and you were discussing about how the code and how workplace racism and being codified can also apply to dealing with our own, with non-white Black people also. And it does. If we, you can apply the same tactics with non-white individuals as we would apply to race soldiers. So, if you just apply the code and just try to the best of your ability to do what you can to try to minimize conflict to the best of your ability, it does work. And I'm just going to continue to just try to implement what I've been learning and from this broadcast and other measures in my life. And that's all I wanted to share, Gus. And thank you again for all your efforts. And that's all I have.
Much obliged. That is accurate. A lot of the counter-racist concepts that we talk about on the job can absolutely be applied with non-white people or with whites on the job or even, outside the work context. And The reason for that is a lot of the foundation of suggestions and strategies with attempted counter-racism, it's just about following logic. And if you're following logic and working with the premise, I'm trying to solve problems without creating new problems, that will generally be very effective regardless of who you are dealing with. Again, whites or non-whites. Others, much obliged, Draftomania. The mail caller that yielded, thank you kindly. Did you have commentary?
Yes, sir. Greetings to the callers, greetings to the listeners, and thank you again, Gus, for the platform. First off, Draftomania, that's great. That's actually pretty good to hear. It's always encouraging, personally, to hear other scenarios where, you know, you've been successful in using the code. That being said, I'll get into some of the commentary from some of the recordings. First off, Maxine Waters, I completely agree with what you stated earlier, Gus. It's very noticeable, the words and phrases that they use as far as describing people that are in that are non-white in so-called powerful positions, such as Maxine Waters, and it's very noticeable how they try to demean those non-white people in very subtle ways, and I think it's shameful and disrespectful. But also, I do give credit to her for speaking up. I do think some of the things, I don't know everything that she stands for as far as her positions on certain political aspects, but VGQ on that, because ultimately, if she's upsetting or Trump, I believe she's doing something somewhat counter-racist, and that is always viewed as a positive in my eye. I have two sons, and discipline has never been a scenario where it has been physical. It can't be, because I'm aware that they're going to get so much verbal abuse. They'll be subjected at an early age by white people and dealing with so much abuse when I'm not around, which is extremely frustrating. But I think by hitting a child physically or verbally abusing them, you're causing even more damage, and that entail leads to them being more confused as to who to turn to communicate some of their frustrations when they may not have the words to even articulate it. So I definitely agree that it definitely does cause damage, but I believe the verbal abuse is probably even more, because even as adults, even when I hear comments from the governor down in Florida in referring to the candidate he's running against, the non-black male, and basically calling him an ape indirectly, it still infuses something in me, or for myself, upsets me to some degree even hearing that. So I think verbal abuse is definitely something to be taken serious. Also, going on to the shooting of the black male security officer, that interview by NPR was just, man.
That was Democracy Now.
It's just Democracy Now. Is just inappropriate. All those questions unnecessary. They have to know that those questions and the things that they were asking them were just completely inappropriate. It just, there was not necessary. And the way I felt when I was hearing it is that the non-black female that was non-white female that was responding, she didn't even seem like she wanted to answer those questions. She didn't even seem like she wanted to be probed that way. Like, it just felt so uncomfortable even listening to that. That being said, I do agree that black men have no position as far as protecting themselves or protecting their families. And, there's a fear there that I think is definitely ingrained in us that we have to definitely work through, and that revolves around really actually having some kind of dialogue about it. But that dialogue can only be had if we're honest about it. That being said, I have one scenario to bring up, and this was a situation where my girlfriend, non-white female, was we had to meet up after work. We worked relatively close to each other, but she was at a different site recently. So she was going back to her site, her main location, to meet up with me. And we were supposed to meet up and just exchange some things and talk a little bit. And when she told her white female coworkers that she had to go back and see me in the main office, the white coworker, the female, said to her, "Well, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do. Don't let him push himself on you." And this is what my girlfriend came back and told me. And I was just astonished because we've been dating for over a year. We've been together for over a year. And it's not like these people haven't seen me frequently. I mean, I don't understand, and that's when I explained to my girlfriend, I said, this is exactly what I'm talking about. And imagine now if you gave them any information in regards to our personal life and anything that we do, these people have nothing positive in mind in regards to black men. And I tried to emphasize that she not forget that as well. But that being said, I will mute my line. Thank you for letting me share.
We used to do workplace racism on Saturdays. That was some time ago, but workplace racism, again, now it's Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, workplace racism. We recommend regularly not sharing a lot of that sort of information and details. And even the man not, that was a specific question that I just asked on the Thursday program, because Dr. Curry has a segment in the text where he talks about savage non-white females needing to be saved from brutish, feverish, no good African males. That's specifically in the man knot. And I asked if there were illustrations of that very same concept or strategy happening now, where black females or non-white females need to be rescued by whites from ogreish, savage black males. And seems like we might have had a workplace illustration right there, but not anything I get, nothing to be surprised about. Again, just to be mindful that's how you are seen on the job. And I would make note of a comment like that being made. Wow, that would definitely be something to have in your workplace notes. Others who dialed in that we have not heard from at all. If you have commentary that you wanted to share. Oh, there was one more thing. Just your use of the term probing with the Democracy Net! Segment on the Illinois shooting, Mr. Roberson, the security guard. I think, or at least for me, there is a necrophilic tone to the way that those type of interviews are conducted. That's what I said before. And I think some of what you were talking about as well, the questions that were asked, and it seemed like his partner, Mr. Robeson's partner, didn't even want to be in the interview with Amy Goodman. I think that is a part of it. And you used the term probing. I think the term probing has at times a sexual connotation. And I think that there is a fetishizing of black necrophilia. It's been one of our terms the whole 10 years that we've been on. I think there is a consumption, and that's Delectable Negro. There is a consumption, a feasting on the corpses, particularly of black males. And I think that's a part of the consumption of these black male corpses. You got to do the interview of the family, and then you get to be all intrusive with them. That's a part of the consumption. You get to take up their time and ask them all these questions and pretend that you're concerned about them and tell us about all of that necrophilia. That's Delectable Negro, Vincent Woodard Book Club, and the man knot, Dr. Tommy Curry, that we're reading right now. But the word probing brought that to my attention. Others that we've not heard from, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings. This is Mon DC calling from a different number. I wanted to say a few things. First, in regards to the political race, I really wanted to compete a lot more than what I did compete. Of course, I did lose that race, but me and my family have been speaking for a while about it, and especially my mother was saying that, you know, white people, they may not kill me, but they may kill my family, so I have to be really careful about that. But so that was one thing. But I keep coming to a point where I keep getting like at a standstill almost for anything because white people are so violent and they might kill me just for being, you know, let alone killing me for doing something effective. And then, so that was one thing. The other thing was about the chemtrails. They haven't slowed down with the chemtrails. White people haven't slowed down. And I noticed earlier this week, the clouds were about as low as I've seen them before. Like you could throw a rock and like I would see the planes once they got about a rock's throw away or maybe a real strong rock's throw away, they would disappear into the clouds, which I hadn't seen them do that before. But I would just say that's probably the clouds would be about as low as whatever I saw all the way up to as high as I could imagine. Those clouds would be very thick in order to keep it cool. I think that, well, I've noticed whenever the clouds are not visible, like whenever they are not spraying the chemtrails, if it's about 3 days of not spraying the chemtrails, to my memory, the temperature is usually in the 70s. And that's no matter what time of year, which I thought was interesting. I'm at the 70s or above. The last thing I wanted to say is that we, of course, need to solve this problem of white people as soon as possible. They're killing black people. And Africa, I've heard very few of their leaders say something about white people. It's not enough. It's not sufficient. And we need to solve the problem. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. I think standstill might be a metaphor. I was going to ask if there have been any updates or just your observations in the, I guess, few weeks that it's been since the Kroger shooting, the white race soldier who shot and killed multiple black people, two black people, also went to a church before. Just any observations or updates in the time since the shooting?
So on the news, I don't watch TV, so but I still hear news. I haven't heard anything. Now from people though, I've heard something. I've heard something to corroborate my suspicion or to. So one of the ladies at the church was saying that somebody had caught the getaway car on camera. So the guy had an accomplice. They caught the guy coming in and getting out of the vehicle. She was saying basically that there was an accomplice and it's caught on camera. Other than that, no, I haven't seen or heard anything. It's just tragic. And I haven't been as active as I had been earlier.
Much obliged for the update. Take as much care as you can. That sort of thing is intended to be terrorizing. That's why we use the term correctly. It is terrorism. So take as much care as you can. I know you were talking about things being intensely unsafe when we spoke with you last. The number again for folks who are with us, 641-715-3640. the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Mr. Steele, if you wanted to share your commentary, again, you got cut off. If you wanted to dial back in, we'd love to hear your commentary in full, uninterrupted. Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, commentary that you want to share, line should be open. Proceed. While we're waiting for folks to get, I guess, their audio and such together, I will make sure that I say again, I think I did mention something about this on the book club. The situation with the Golden State Warriors, man, the 10 stops, Neely Fuller Jr., to have one of the greatest basketball teams of all time. And they're talking about what could possibly ruin things? Name calling? Wow. 10 stops, one of the minimums that we can do. I am not going to name call. And then especially in a workplace environment, I am not going to name call another black person. That is totally incorrect. And in the system of white supremacy, exactly what happened in this incident, what does that allow for? Racists to come in and say, we will settle it. Our niggers are having a spat. We will settle the spat. Come on, children. We will decide what this is going to be. That's what happened in this incident. That's what happens in most of the incidents when we allow our emotions maybe to get the best of us and end up getting in some sort of name-calling verbal altercation in a workplace setting. But no name-calling. 10 stops. Simple things that we can do to work against racism, white supremacy. Again, and if we have parents, this is not a spectator broadcast. Parents, corporal punishment. Do we have folks that are engaging in it, think it's constructive, particularly if we have folks who are current parents? Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Good evening, everyone. Very good discussion. I was watching a clip of CNN, and I just wanted to give, I guess this will be a new book because it's not supposed to be out till the beginning of next year. The author's name is Stephanie, I should say doctor because she graduated, Dr. Stephanie E. Jones Rogers, and the book is called They Were Her Property, White Women as Slave Owners in the American South. That probably will be interesting. You might be able to get on the show, and maybe she can send you an advance copy. This won't be until February, a potential interview guest. That's pretty much all I have for now. But I heard that because when I heard it, I was like, oh, yeah, that sounds really interesting. So I just wanted to let you know. Thank you.
Much obliged. That does sound very interesting. They were her property. Very interesting text. We will have to check out. Is it Dr. Jones? We'll have to.
Stephanie E. Jones Rogers.
Jones Rogers.
She's at, where is she? Oh, she's at UC Berkeley. Yeah, she's at UC Berkeley. And like I said, they invited her to be on CNN with Don Lemon. So she's been on TV, whatever. But yeah, that's the name of the book. And it's supposed to be out, according to this website, February 19th, 2019. So it's definitely coming out. They announced it on CNN because that's how I heard about it. So,
okay.
There you go.
I will do some research to read more about the book and maybe see if I can find the interview. But that does sound very interesting. White role of white women. I talked about them before throughout the system.
I can send you, I guess, the clip from YouTube that I saw with her, so you see her. I'm assuming she's, I know I've seen the other people, she would be the African American person. And then that's that.
Much obliged. Thank you kindly.
No problem.
Thank you kindly. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, parents especially, commentary, questions, suggestions, line should be open. Proceed. Give folks a bit more time as they're getting their thoughts together, I reckon, and check in with some of the other folks. I can't even messed up one of my notes about the shooting situation. That's another one. I don't know if they have video that I'm not going to pay attention to. I think the caller that mentioned previously about being bothered about Mr. Gillum being referred to as a monkey and then being bothered about having to hear the interview with Democracy Now. And they thought, I think the phrasing used was buck breaking. Terrorism, its design, and just continuing to watch that. I've encouraged not watching video footage for any of that. I don't know if they have video footage of Mr. Roberson's shooting and what have you, but be very mindful about that sort of content. If you do have children, I'd be mindful about, you know, their sort of exposure and talk to them to see how they're feeling, what they're thinking, because I'm sure these images are impacting them. Dr. Curry talks about that in The Man Knot, and how content having this constantly streamed, black male death especially, black male death, black male death, black male death. How does that impact black males and black boys, seeing that and having that paraded as a normal part of existence? Also with that case, sobriety would be best. That was not something that I could minimize the setting for this being in a bar. Now, he was at work. It wasn't like Mr. Roberson was just there, you know, having fun. That's his occupation, understood. But even still, with that, just everything about that environment with the alcohol, that's why I say that at the at the conclusion of the broadcasts, places where there's alcohol consumption, they generally just are not the safest places to be. In a system of racism, white supremacy, frequently violence and name calling. A lot of times it'll be something that simple, name calling, and then everything, you know, not the safest places to be. There is a reason that is something that is emphasized. Sobriety would be best, and avoiding environments where there's going to be a lot of profuse alcohol consumption, bars, raving parties, that sort of thing. Folks still live to get, or I guess if the folks that we've not heard from, any of the other folks who dialed in, did you have additional? Oh, never mind. Other folks who dialed in, let's see, the person at 7433, did you have commentary?
Yes, sir. How you doing, Gus?
Right, poorly.
Greetings to all the callers. I just wanted to speak about the minimizing conflict, and I'm also a parent, so it goes together as far as minimizing conflict, because like the last caller said, I do think verbal abuse is probably it's probably a little bit worse than physical abuse, because I used to be verbally abused as a child, and sometimes that still carries over as an adult, and it carries over sometime when raising, you know, your children. And I was the minimizing conflict part. I had a family member that did some kind of jacked up things. I'm sorry, that's a metaphor, but just did some wrongful things, and had to call the police out. And the police were just so focused on me, going into more having conflict with the family member, but the family member wasn't around. So they were just more focused on, oh, well, did you know who did it? Or did you have any reason for him to do it? Like, hey, man, look, I didn't see anybody do anything. I'm just trying to get a police report for my insurance. And they harassed me more just trying to get a police report for the insurance and worrying about what was the conflict like between me and the other non-white black person. And from what I've seen, just being at work or being out in public, once you get into a kind of like a conflict with another non-white person while a white person is around, their eyes just go to get glowing, and they almost want to pull out popcorn, so to speak, while you're right there. But what I found to work mostly is remaining calm in your conversation with that non-white person and asking them, hey, man, can we step to the side? If there's a white person around, hey, man, can we step to the side and talk in private? And then when you get them in private, allow them to speak so you can remain calm. Allow them to speak and you can hear their response. And then that'll be able to tell you how you can give your response. And like I said, it goes in with the parenting, because if your child, you know, does anything that's, you know, irresponsible or something like that, just try to remain calm and speak in a, you know, in a calm manner, and let them get their side out and what, you know, and how it happened, and opposed to, you know, a non-white parent being verbally abusive and like, oh, you stupid, or why you do this dumb stuff, you know, the typical. And that's all I have. I'm in my line.
Great suggestion in terms of if it does look like there could be a problem, especially in a work situation or anywhere else, but especially in a work situation, there could be a problem with another non-white person, to see if you can speak to that person in private. A lot of times that can be helpful, because frequently non-white people, we don't want to feel like someone is trying to humiliate us in public, in front of, you know, our other coworkers. Like, you're not going to disgrace me in front of everyone, when you can get all of that attention away, where it's just you. And so now we're not, exactly as you said, we're not entertainment for everyone else. So you're not going to make me look bad in front of everybody. It can just be, you know, let's just try and see if we can solve this reasonably without having, you know, racists come in here and maybe fire us both. Things can go a lot better if you can get it moved privately. Sometimes you might have to control your emotions to, you know, change the geography to your liking. Let's see. The person that dialed in, last four digits, 5771. Did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. This is Henry from Chicago. Wanted to comment on the Roberson incident, since the place where the murder took place at, you know, I live like about 20 minutes away from it. It's a Manny's bar where he was shot at is in Robbins, Illinois. And what's so interesting, and it's a suburb of Chicago, but what's so interesting about that is the cop who shot him was a Midlothian policeman. Now, if you look at where Manny's bar is at, it's in Robbins, but it's bordering another suburb of Blue Island, which is east of Robbins. Now, Midlothian is actually south of Robbins, but it's actually a good 3 miles from where that bar is. So one of the questions is, how does Midlothian police respond to an incident in Robbins, whereas, it, like I said, it's like 3 miles away? And, you know, we were all wondering here, okay, where was how come the Robbins police never shot Mr. Roberson? So it's like, you know, and just to give you a demographic of the area. Now, Robbins, Illinois is like 98% non-white black people. Midlothian is majority white. And from my understanding, dealing with Midlothian police, I think all of them are white. I don't think there's any non-white black people or any non-white people that's on the Midlothian police force. So that's, you know, that's something that, that, you know, we're all trying to, you know, wonder, you know, the well, you know, I didn't want to use the metaphor holes in the story, but, you know, it's obvious that this is, you know, police terrorism going on here into a majority black, you know, suburb. Also, too, driving through Midlothian, there are with some of the trees, there are, I guess they're wrapping like these blue ribbons around the tree in support of, you know, the officer. Like I said, Midlothian, majority white people. So that's all I have right now. I'm in my line.
He said in support of the officer who hasn't even been named. Like, how is the anonymous killer in need of support? What type of support exactly? Voltron, again, that is a metaphor, but whites supporting other whites who practiced racism, white supremacy, and particularly when whites have killed a black person, often a black male, oh, wow, they come with all kinds of support. All the help you need, we got invoke the great, the hate you give. Got your back, they got your back. You kill, go out and shoot and kill some niggers, we got your back. Don't even worry about it. Supporting the anonymous, unnamed white killer. And great point about the officer responding who is not even in the same location, same jurisdiction, as they say. That's an important point as well. I have seen where some officers have been terminated. I know that happened in Washington State where it was an officer responded. It was some, you know, sort of major incident, and an officer was in a different jurisdiction and was one of the first responders, and that was grounds for termination. They said that that's not even your jurisdiction. What are you doing over there? Let's see, others that we have not heard from at all. If you have commentary to share, line should be open. Folks are waiting. Still see a few more hands. I would encourage the folks that do have hands up that we've not heard from at all to not lollygag too long, because we do have less than 30 minutes remaining in the broadcast. So if you think you have a question, thought, idea, make sure that you share it soon. If there are other folks who are with us, if you have comments, questions, feel free. Since I did mention the hate you give, and someone, they posted on my face, it happened, someone emailed me, and then someone wrote on my page about the movie. I am not watching the movie. I think I said emphatically after we read the horrid text, there was no way, and I would encourage others not to watch the film. So I do not care what's in the movie. They could have a poster of Gus T. Renegade is a coon in the middle of the movie, and I do not care. That would not make me want to watch the film to see it, even to get a screenshot. So yeah, please, I have no interest in what's in the film. If they made it even anything close to the book, I already know anti-blackness and a lot of black misandry in addition to cowbell. Got it. Other folks who dialed in, let's see. Oh, Mr. Steele, I think we might have him back. Mr. Steele, did we get you back, sir?
Yeah, I just need a couple minutes.
Yes, sir. Take your time, and you can just start from the beginning, because we basically didn't get to hear anything that you were going to say about the Roberson situation. While Mr. Steele is getting himself situated, Any of the other folks that we've heard from already have it. Oh, wait a minute. I don't know if retired firefighter was with us for this evening or not, but Dr. Brenda Snipes, we had talked about the Florida situation, and I believe within the past 48 hours, Ms. Abrams conceded and Mr. Gillum conceded for the second time in the Florida situation. So all of that is, you know, done. They can just go about who they're going to blame. But they had Dr. Brenda Snipes, the black female in Broward County in South Florida, where they were saying, oh, man, something went awry with the voting. This Negro woman here, she's to blame. She messed up the votes. They had her. She's already stepping down. She's, you know, resigning her post and what have you. But they had her on television today on the news. And they said that there was a discrepancy of 2,000 ballots in Broward County that were misplaced or whatever happened to them. And they had her up in front of the room. What happened? You tell what happened to those ballots? And she's explaining, well, we put them in the basket here. And, you know, we did the recount. We did the machine recount. We got everything situated. And they said, oh, you didn't. You lied. You messed it up. You can't believe you violated our. I said this last racial showcasing. System of racism, white supremacy, and it comes down to black female, elderly at that, black female is to blame for messing up the election and misplacing these, allegedly misplacing these 2,000 ballots. Racial theater through and through. And she's already stepping. Other folks, did you all have commentary? We're waiting for Mr. Steele.
Hello.
Can I hear? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Did you speak? I already spoke. Did you speak before?
No, ma'am. You could go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I sent the information I was going to send. And reminding about the voting, you're correct about Dr. Snipes. I never heard of her before. And they also said there were issues in other counties in Florida, but you didn't see any of those people. So I guess I would have to look them up on my own. But I believe me that those other people may not be identified as black because they were like Palm Beach County. They had four or five other counties they were talking about, but she's the only one that seems to be, I guess, in trouble or got in trouble, so to speak. And also about this push for voting, I was all for voting, but these people are really getting on my nerves. They sent me some kind of postcard with black people on the front saying you need to go out and vote because your participation is average compared to your community. I'm like, I've lived here 3 years. They've only had two voting years because one year, last year, 2017, there was absolutely no reason to vote where I live. They didn't have any elections about anything. And I'm really just getting tired of this push about these people forcing me to vote. I know when to vote. I got the memo. I told them, I said, you call me again, I'm not voting for anybody. Leave me alone. But they really do try to bully black people, trying to make them feel bad, and it really is an epidemic or something. Some people need to talk about that as well. Thank you.
Wow. Bullying you to vote. Make it a short conversation. I think that was one of the suggestions I gave before to make sure that doesn't get into a long quarrel or argument, and particularly if you've already made up your mind about it. The male caller who yielded.
And on the voting topic, I just wanted to report here. Last week in the Illinois 3rd congressional race, there was a avowed Nazi, basically a guy who claimed the Nazi Party or Nazism, Mr. Art Jones, who ran on the Republican ticket. He eventually lost, but the 3rd congressional district in Illinois consists of some parts of the south side of Chicago and south suburbs. Art Jones got 56,000 votes, an avowed Nazi. And they found out that roughly about 40,000 of them came from Chicago, south side of Chicago at that. So, and in one particular neighborhood, Mount Greenwood, which is basically, kind of like a sundown town. I know that's a metaphor, but that's the only thing I can think of right now. But he got 3,800 votes from that particular neighborhood in Chicago. So that's all I wanted to say, and I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Mr. Steele, yes, sir.
Yeah, just a second here. Wait, hello?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Okay, so I am currently, I think I'm still in Whittier, California. And I just wanted to say that, like I was saying earlier, the shooting that occurred, or the murder of the security guard, I think it's, I think you were right in saying that it's a perfect illustration of the reality that black male space, where we can't even defend ourselves. And oftentimes in situations where a normal person or a person would naturally figure to defend themselves, oftentimes we're put in a spot where we can't because of fear of reprisal. I've always wondered how the good guy with a gun scenario would end if a black person was the good guy with the gun. And that scenario, it ended like you would think it would. And it's just your worst. It's just the worst. It's just the worst even hearing about that. And the response is very telling. The fact that, you know, there seems to be no recourse for this. In fact, the state is rallying behind the shooter, it seems. So it's very disturbing what you're seeing here. The trend the Nazi that won in Chicago, I think Mount Greenwood is a South Chicago neighborhood. I think it might be ethnically Irish, and I do know that they have a lot of law enforcement that live in that area. So, you know, there is a Nazi that is running in Chicago or in the Chicagoland area, and he received thousands of votes. I think one report said that he had something like over 20% of the returns. So if you recall to your history, the Nazi Party of Germany, they did not start out being all of them. They started out as a kind of a slow amassing of public support that thrived off of just unchecked demonstrations of barbarism and cruelty, and it was and nobody stopped it. And I think the same scenario is playing out where we have today, where by people are behaving in ways that are increasingly more obviously racist, especially to victims, because it seems that prior to recently, there was some sort of refinement to racism that doesn't seem to be present now. And it just seems to be increasing that people are feeling comfortable doing things and exhibiting behaviors that are identified as racist. So I'm looking at all of these occurrences, and I'm just wondering, is staying in the United States the best idea for a black person? I feel kind of like what a Jewish person in Germany must have felt like, just seeing the society become more obviously against them. And it's very unsettling. I'm going to go ahead and mute my line now. Thank you.
That is a simile, feeling like the Germans in Nazi. That's a type of metaphor, but
I do think an important difference in that metaphor, it's why I do encourage to at least investigating the comparisons with the system of racism, white supremacy being worldwide. I don't know any place, any location, any so-called nation that would step forward and say, oh, yes, we are here to protect the American Negro. Come here. Stay with us. Hang out. We got you. I think it might be a totally different situation if there were going to be escalated direct violence against black people in this part of the world in terms of the response. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from, if you have commentary, line should be open, and we have about 15 minutes left. So if you've not spoken at all, you should definitely speak up now. If we have others who had a comment or question they wanted to share, feel free.
Not be heard.
Yes, sir. Caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Speaking on the voting situation and Ms. Snipes having to, I think, resign. I read an article where apparently for the recount, the two primary counties that were being mentioned were, I believe it was Broward and Palm Beach County, I think. And I think the situation with Palm Beach was they were recounting, I think, with the machine. They did the machine method, and then something about it broke down. The machine, or the machines, I guess, broke down so-called halfway through the recount, okay? And they hadn't even finished before the due date, so it didn't seem like it was very clear. I guess they were trying to do the U.S. Senate one, and they didn't get all the votes in by the due date time. And as far as the Broward County, there was an article that said that, and especially to add to the racial theater, they said something about they did get the votes finished, but they missed the deadline by 2 minutes, apparently. I guess this is a true factual report, but that's from what I read in some of these articles. I don't know if you read that, Gus, or anything, but it really does go to that the tackiness. And also just to focus on the black female, you know, a black person being the focus of all of this racist aggression. And it just very well demonstrates and displays the system of white supremacy. There was another one was there was a news report that I saw, I think it was on Inside Edition, where it were these a lot of these young white males were taking a picture, I guess, out of school, and they were doing apparently a Nazi salute. And on the next day, it showed that, hey, you know, there was one of the students in the upper right part of the picture who did not raise his hand when he heard that they were going to do this Nazi salute. But the other children were told to just raise their hand. But when you look at the photograph, who raises their hand like that? Unless they were going on codification, it was communicated to them to, quote unquote, raise your hand. So obviously they're not going to directly tell them to do a Nazi salute. Just what we'll go by the code, when I say raise your hand, you will begin to do this act. So it's definitely white codification on that. So it made it seem like, well, hey, there's still hope. Don't despair. There's still hope when you got this one white person who knew what was going on and said, hey, I knew what that was all about. So I didn't raise my hand. I didn't want to do that. That's just something that's just wrong. But they still are excluding the whole other group of young white males that proceeded to do the Nazi salute. So once again, white supremacy being practiced. And my last question was, Gus, that audio segment where the guy was asking the reporter about, do you know about race? I was trying to hear the statement he made, something about, he said, do you have like a gap in your teeth? Or what did he say? I was trying to make out what he said. I don't know who he was talking to.
I thought he was talking to another white person. Now, again, I couldn't really see the person that he was talking to. They weren't on the video. But I thought he told, based on what he said, it sounded like he was talking to a white person. And he told them, even though you have that gap in your teeth, we are a part of the master race. I thought that's what he said. Even though you have that gap in your teeth, we, meaning you're white, I'm white, we are still part of the master race.
Well, yeah, that's very interesting comment to make. I've never really heard anything like that. But as far as my commentary, that's pretty much all that I have for now. I'll give it to the next person, and thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged. I do just want to say really quickly about the voting machines. He said the quote, this is from the New York Times, is, I don't want you to think I'm picking on you because we're part of the master race. You know, you've got that gap in your teeth. You're the master race. Don't ever forget that. That's the quote, New York Times. The voting machines, that's what I was saying, where they said that some of the machines didn't work, and that's what maybe caused some of the problems. And I read that online in some of the other areas where they said a machine overheated in one area where they had to do a recount, and that messed things up. I'm making a comparison. Now, I just looked on Amazon. You can get sex gadgets, all kinds of crude things delivered in less than 24 hours. You're telling me democracy, who's going to be governor for the next 4 years, and all the decisions that come with that, we can't even get quality working voting machines. You can go on Amazon Prime right now and get gadgets delivered to you in less than 24 hours. We can't order a quality voting machine. That's what I mean about the tackiness of the system of racism, white supremacy. You're going to tell me on one hand, this is really important. Every vote or die. That's what they said. Vote or die. Get out and do this. You're going to kill Dr. Brenda Snipes because of the results of this. And then you can't even invest and have quality. And this is the same thing that they said in 2000 when the machines didn't. Other folks have commentary that they want to make sure they share before we conclude.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I just saw this article. It's really short. It says George Zimmerman entered a no contest plea to resolve a misdemeanor charge of stalking a private investigator in the latest run-in with the law for the neighborhood watch leader who killed Trayvon Martin. Zimmerman will be placed on a 12-month probation, during which time he is not allowed to possess a firearm. Zimmerman entered the no contest plea and absentia, meaning he did not have to be present at the courthouse. Under such a plea, a defendant doesn't admit guilt. A conviction is withheld if the conditions of the plea are met. I just want to share that with you.
Duly noted. Context of white. Mr. Steele?
What is that? That sentence is very, very similar to the sentence that is given to youthful offenders in first-time youthful offenders in the state of Michigan. I know because I've received a similar sentence. In fact, his sentence, the terms of his probation are in fact lighter than the terms of the probation that I was put on for less serious crimes. I mean, this person, these were violent misdemeanors that this person was being charged with. So I think it's very, very interesting, that sentence. I also wanted to mention earlier when you played that clip with the, I think the genetic drive or the genetic modification of the mosquitoes. If you listen to that clip again, perhaps on the replay, you'll notice that I don't know if anybody else noticed. I don't know if you noticed, Gus. Did you notice the person being interviewed, the British or the person located in Britain that was being interviewed? Did you notice he became very apprehensive about discussing anything that they were doing in, I think, Burkina Faso?
His responses seemed interesting in general. I think I don't know what term I would use to describe it, but he seemed defensive. I think that would be one. He seemed certainly defensive when she asked, or I think she just made a statement that they were doing research with this new genetic technology in Burkina Faso. And he immediately was like, oh, no, we're not. We're not using this there.
Right.
And then when she asked if it's possible that using these genetically modified mosquitoes, if this could impact other species. And he said, well, it's doubtful. And I thought, well, even wow, that's an interesting response to the question. A number of the responses, the way that he answered the questions in that segment, I thought, wow, this would give me more reason to doubt and think, wow, yeah, they're going to be using this for all types of incorrect purposes.
And the responses that he gave, and even the clarification that he gave of what they were doing in Burkina Faso, he alleged that the mosquito samples that they were using for that test were only going to be around for one generation and then they would die off. And they could be easily taken out of the population. And I thought that was very interesting because they can't control for GMOs. One of the problems with when they talk about genetically modified organisms as far as plants go is cross-pollinization, whereby some plants will pollinate other plants, and then those plants will take on the characteristics of the GMO, the designer GMO plant. And I just thought it was very interesting that he made that distinction between, these samples and the other samples, and insisted that they weren't going to have any sort of long-lasting effects. I think he's lying.
I can certainly understand the logic of why you would think, yeah, they're being deceptive. He's being deceptive in what they're saying about how this technology is going to be employed. That makes total logical sense. We have 30 seconds. Did anybody need a comment they can share in 30 seconds or less? Everyone satisfied? Grant, we will call it a broadcast. We will be here. Dr. Tommy Curry mentioned already repeatedly the man, not race, class, genre, and dilemmas of Black manhood. Segment number 4. This book is not that long. I think we could be done with this book before the new year. I'm not sure. Have to look again, but it's not that long. Challenging read, but not too difficult. Again, if you have questions, drop an email. We can share. Dr. Curry knows we are reading the book. Workplace Racism, Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Check Black Talk Radio Network and the Facebook page for updates for other programs. Oh, man, the holiday. I forgot. Man, be codified. If you are doing
any traveling, if you are hosting relatives, if you're visiting relatives for the quote unquote horror days, you should still be codified. I know we've talked, or we've done so many of these at this point, where folks have talked about conflict coming up or attempting to talk about racism, white supremacy, or just things happening with all of this. Just, hey, we still want to make sure that we are invoking, utilizing counter racist strategies, minimizing conflict being number one, not forcing conversation on racism, white supremacy. You don't even have to talk. You can be quiet, allow them to talk, listen. That can even be used among family members. With that, from Mr. Roberson, shot and killed at a bar. Again, that was his place of employment. It wasn't like, you know, he was out and about and such, but still, Jen, just the environment. That's what I expect. That sort of violence, problems, that's what I would expect. That's why I say consistently, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Certainly, don't want to be mixing whites and alcohol. That is, you know, absolutely an environment to avoid under all circumstances. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time that we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers like Daniel Holtzclaw, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.